you so much for the morning show theme song on this Monday, May 23rd, 2016. And I sent out my newsletter late last night. If you are a subscriber, you received it. If not, send me an email, halginsburg1963@gmail.com, halginsburg1963@gmail.com, and I'll add you to the list so you can get the newsletter. Or just, you don't even have, I mean, just go to my website, halginsburg.com. They have some new listeners, I'm hoping a few, people I caught up with or maybe even met for the first time at my 30th college reunion over the weekend. That was fun. I had an enjoyable day. Just really went for one day. Did not stay over. Many stayed over Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. So you could go for three nights. I was just there for the day Saturday with my friend Rick. We drove up that morning and stayed through the late afternoon into the cocktail party hour. Talked to a few people there that I had either close acquaintance with or a friendship with, or people who I, again, just may have met for the first time, and discussed the website, the program I do. Some expressed evinced real interest. So if you're a new listener because you want to check me out, the best thing you can do is either email me or call me during the show, 844-367-4254. And comment. That would be really, really nice. You can also tweet me. I never talk about that, but I have a very small and very slowly growing Twitter following at Hal Ginsburg. And of course, there are a number of ways you can reach me on Facebook, the Hal Ginsburg Morning Show. And just, you can friend me or ask to friend me. And I'm probably, not always, but probably will approve your request. I enjoyed that reunion. I want to talk about that for a bit. The first event I attended was the morning on Saturday when the president spoke to a lecture in a lecture hall, and it wasn't, you know, I thought it would be filled. I mean, this was the president of the university, President Roth. He's pretty well known. You may have read some of his writings without even knowing who he was, or you may have known who he was, or you may never have read what he's written, but he is a pretty prolific writer. He is an evangelist for liberal education, and I called up this morning on my computer, HuffPost College here, Why Liberal Education Matters, a lecture in Beijing. And this is basically his book, which he just published. I don't know, did he just publish it? Maybe it's a couple of years old now. The lecture predated the book. The book is, however, also called, I believe, Why Liberal Education Matters. And he talked about what he calls, I guess, the four pillars. Yeah, Beyond the University. That's the book. Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. And he spent about an hour, I don't know, 45 minutes talking about his book. And he has sort of these four pillars or four, you know, there's the coach of the legendary coach at UCLA basketball, John Wooden, has his pillars or his pyramid. And so Roth has like his four keys to a great college to really liberal education. And I don't even remember what they were, but they rhyme: cooperation, I believe, instigation. And then what were the other two? I'm going to see. It's in his lecture at China. Here we go. Liberation, animation, cooperation. And then he does instigation/innovation, and he just threw out the innovation altogether. So it's liberation, animation, cooperation, instigation. I thought it was pretty interesting, freeing up the mind so that you're open to new ideas and you're able to really fully explore them. Animation, so you're excited by what you're learning. Cooperation, people working together to share what they've learned, what they are learning, and then instigation, where you actually start to go beyond actually what you've learned and instigate into new areas. Instigate your instructor to learn more, to delve more, to be willing, your instructor, your professor, your teacher, to actually question her assumptions, to question the underlying ideas which she has believed are most important. So I thought that was interesting. Liberation, animation, cooperation, instigation. I thought, well, Professor Roth, I call him Professor. I guess some call him Dr. Roth. One, there was a question and answer session. One questioner called him Mr. President. Michael said, I would just call him, my son said, just call him President Roth. That probably would have been best. I avoided all of it by just asking my question without addressing him directly with a moniker. But if I had, I probably would have said professor, maybe because I was in a lecture hall and he was acting as a professor would, walking around the classroom and looking into your eyes as he was talking, as professors are wont to do, at least good ones. He was good. Like I said, I was thinking, though, while he was speaking, that if you're a hammer, you know, the old idea, if you're a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And I guess if you're an academic, then every problem you resolve through education. And he did focus to a degree on income inequality. He did focus on the importance the university has in the role, the crucial role, the essential ness of a university opening its doors to poor students from backgrounds where they normally wouldn't be able to afford to attend or may not have had the academic background attending poor schools, schools that don't do as good a job educating as elite high schools and boarding schools and the like, prep schools. But I think where he fell a little short is recognizing, and I asked this very question, actually, that it's not simply the university that reflects back to society in the end, but the society that has far more control over the university. So my point was that the incredible income inequalities, the economic injustice that permeates our society, extraordinary wealth. I mean, just beyond people's imaginations. Robert Reich talks about this at Yahoo in 2015. The company lost over, you know, well over $4 billion. But the president, the CEO, Marissa Mayer, was compensated to the tune of $36 million. And that money is so vast, so extraordinary, people have no concept how much it is. Almost no one, I'm sure no one listening to my show, will make in throughout their entire lives anywhere near $36 million. It is just a irrational amount of money. And yet one individual who helmed a corporation that lost, you know, over 100 times that amount. Got it. That was what she was paid. I don't believe in a society where you have that kind of compensation. At the same time, you have 20% or more of the populace living in poverty. You know, people know how much Marissa Mayer makes. You know her name. You probably may, you know, recognize her. You know the names of lots of multimillionaires, athletes, actors, CEOs. They're a tiny little handful, a patina, a little sheen over a society where there are tens of millions of us who may go to sleep hungry, who have food insecurity, who don't know where our rent money will come from. It will have enough. I think that is the crucial issue of our time. And President Roth, Dr. Roth, Professor Roth seems to believe, and this is very frustrating to me, that the university, that Wesleyan University, it's, you know, a prestigious school. It's relatively affluent. That somehow by giving out scholarships and welcoming people and helping people who come to the school who may not have had sufficient preparation, that's enough, that will make things hunky-dory for the kids at Wesleyan. Obviously, he's not going to claim. He's not, you know, going to say, well, you know, what we do here will make things better for people who aren't at the school. Although I think he would say the purpose of a liberal education is not just to educate the people who attend the school and make life better for them, but to have them go out and, as he said, instigate change. But I think he misses the broader point, which is that it's the university itself that has been changed by society, that has become less capable of changing the world by virtue of these forces. And I think that's what's so frustrating. And I'll just close on this point. And please call me if you want to comment, because maybe I'm not quite as coate as I'd like to be. Maybe I need to write about this. As I walked out of exited the lecture hall, where I was really very much captivated by the president's speech. Speaking wasn't really a speech, his lecture and his responses to questions after the fact. I was captivated by him. But I walked out, and there were a bunch of his books that people are selling. You know, you say, get them while they're hot. Professor Roth, Dr. Roth, President Roth's new book, Beyond the University, and even that new. And I thought, you know, that's not cool, is it? Is that a little cheesy, a little hammy? I think it is. I really do. If you want to give away some books, that's great. But the message sent is, hey, you want me to educate you, you got to pay. Michael said, my son, after I've told him about this, he said, well, that's why you go to reunions, right? That's why they have them, so they can squeeze money out of you. I think there's truth to that. I don't reject that out of hand. But then if that's the case, shouldn't it be the university itself that is... And I think he had even said the money was going to go to some good cause. It didn't feel right. If you're going to have a reunion and you want to raise money, then be overt about it and have the money be directed to the university itself, not to the president, who I'm sure he's well into the, not in the seven figures, but well into the high to mid six figure salary. And that, by the way, is a piker. The piker compared to Marissa Meyer. Well, let's go to a break. What troubles me, and I see this, you know, it's like it's that old thing, if you're a hammer, every problem is a nail. Your university president, the solution to every problem is education. And we just have to change the way we distribute wealth in America. I mean, that is the ultimate solution, but that's not your president of the university. You're elite. All I need is just more time to teach people, to educate. That's not going to solve our problems. What solves our problems is we take wealth and power away from the few and redistribute them to the many. Education is crucial, but the first order of business has to be some equitable distribution of wealth and power in America today. All right, let's go to a break. 844-4-HELGY. I'd love to talk to you. 844-367-4254. I'm going to continue with this theory, though, this leitmotif that when you're a hammer, you're an academic, or whatever your job is, that every solution is the one that you're trained to, that you're trained to handle. So if you're a teacher, then just teaching is enough. If you're a business person, then business, trade, commerce will solve everything. If you're a financier, then just financing, figuring out new ways to lend money will solve our problems. It was fascinating to see that. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Warehouse workers at the Port of Los Angeles are speaking out against a freight handling company that left dozens of cargo loaders jobless recently. California Cartage, one of the nation's largest drayage companies, switched temporary staffing agencies.
Labor activists said the move was retaliation against workers for raising awareness of unfair and unsafe working conditions. Ernesto Arce has more from Los Angeles.
Dozens of freight handlers at the Port of Los Angeles lost their jobs on Friday, April 30th, after California Cartage replaced AMR-SSI, a temporary staffing agency, with another firm. The company asked workers to reapply with Core Employee Management, a new agency, but many fell through the cracks. Michael Munoz, an organizer with the Warehouse Workers Resource Center, says Cal Cartage didn't actually fire anyone, it pushed them out.
Come May 1st, anywhere between 70 to 100 people actually didn't get in for a bunch of different reasons. They told people, well, you have a problem with your Social Security number, or you have a problem with your background check, or your application is still not processed, or we actually have no record of you. The agency never called to resolve the issue, so a lot of those people actually wound up getting jobs somewhere else.
The Labor Center has been supporting Cal Cartage workers for 2 years now. Back in December 2014, it helped workers file a lawsuit against the freight handling company for violating the Los Angeles Living Wage Ordinance.
It's like one of the worst places to work ever.
Why would you say that?
The unsure feeling if, like, you're going to make it home, because the way everybody drives, I mean, it's brutal.
The AFL-CIO and several unions are calling on Congress to oppose H.R. 5278, a bill on Puerto Rico known as PROMESA. Labor is urging Congress to act immediately to provide a path for comprehensive debt restructuring and a return to sustainable economic growth for the 3.5 million U.S. citizens living in Puerto Rico. The AFL-CIO says that the people of Puerto Rico are facing an urgent humanitarian crisis brought on by more than a decade of recession, excessive debt, and demands for Wall Street austerity. AFSCME, SEIU, the UAW, United Steelworkers, UFCW, and IAM are all joining the AFL-CIO in urging Congress to pass a restructuring package for Puerto Rico that includes protecting pensions and labor rights.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org. Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I was mistaken. I thought I'd heard your words. Tell me how do I feel? Tell me now how do I feel? Those who came before me lived through devastation.
All right, back on the Ginsburg Show, May 23rd. It's a Monday, 2016. 6:25 now. On the left coast, the Pacific coast, where David from San Francisco is calling in. Again, I was talking about my college reunion and I went to three lectures, and really it just did strike me that, people get their tunnel vision and they're focused on one particular aspect of a problem through their career choice, through their profession. And that is the lens that they filter every solution through. So for Professor Dr. President Roth, the solution is education, and I think it's a big part of it, but he didn't get how distorted the university has become by virtue of living in a society where there's just such massive economic inequality, such rampant economic injustice, people having to work 50, 60 hours a week just to survive, if that. And we saw that. One sec, Dave. I'll get to you right. One second, Dave. I hear David talking about it. I haven't put him there. I'll get to him in one little instant. And we saw that also simply in the vetting of a graduate from my class who is a managing director, managing partner. I don't know if he's a director. I don't know what the exact title is at Goldman Sachs, giving tens, perhaps tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, all the applause and, the sucking up. And it's because of this need, this constant need to feed, to feed the rich kids, to attract wealthy students, people who can pay the full freight, full tuition. And in the end, hopefully we'll be giving huge grants and donations to the university, and therefore allowing the professors and, most importantly, of course, the administrators to raise their own salaries. Let's go to David, sorry for holding you there for just an extra beat. Good morning.
No, that's no problem, Hal. As a matter of fact, that makes a great intro because that's kind of where I was going to go. And by the way, do you get to hear those ads just as you're coming up? Or maybe it was like a little news thing. They were talking about some ports that were bad retraining and bad rehiring.
I guess that would be the Workers Independent News. That was before I came on. Are you talking about? Because I played that, but sometimes I'm not listening when I'm playing the breaks because I've got to do other, you know, I've got to get prepared for the next segment or clear out something or other that might be on my screen. So I didn't,
I
didn't
could
catch
tie
that.
Go ahead. Yeah, I could tie that to what you were just talking about because it was they were basically also talking about the fake economy. And you're old enough to remember, I mean, I'm late 50s, and I remember the baby boom has had to retrain at least five times. You know, it's not like the buggy whip manufacturers had to retrain but once in their lifetime. We had to retrain five times and go through insane economics each time. Each time there was a looting of America, the baby boom had to retrain. And now we're going into robots taking the last of the menial jobs, and the educated are working at Quickie Mart. And it's going to be just as easy to put in vending machines and security cameras, and you know they could have a world without people, and so it's gotten to be so insane that you're talking about your class reunion, you're talking about people that have had to retrain. They thought that they were going to have a meaningful life, and they've had to throw away their dreams multiple times. And class reunions have got to be horrible at this point.
Well, I guess it just depends on, you know, who you talk to. But I thought one thing I did notice, and I haven't mentioned this, you kind of brought to my attention, is there was kind of a little bit of a schism. So you had the Goldman Sachs partner who was obviously extraordinarily wealthy, and he was there with his parents, each of whom had a new spouse. So there were two families representing his parents. His husband was there as well. And I think they'd all flown in probably on a private jet from Los Angeles. So you have these very affluent, I mean, beyond, you know, people's dreams of affluence, even when we were in college. But other folks I talked to at the reunion kind of had to downsize their expectations. People who had grown up in, you know, upper middle class circumstances in Manhattan now can no longer afford to live in Manhattan, which has become, especially once you get south of the 96th Street or 125th Street on the west side, it's basically just for the rich and powerful. That's the only people who can afford to live on an island. People moving to the, now, I'm not, you know, crying tears for them. I'm just pointing out that you are really seeing that split between the very, very fortunate few and everyone else who's kind of maybe seen their lives not work out quite as well as they had hoped or expected.
Sure. Well, and that's what, if you go to, you remember who Pol Pot was?
Yeah, Cambodia? He was the guy who murdered 3 million people in Cambodia?
Well, it was even more insidious than that. Pol Pot was after Vietnam was settling down late in mid-70s, all of a sudden this great big dictator from Cambodia showed up, and he started killing teachers, doctors, and the educated, basically, of Cambodia. He was going to create a new slave society by killing the educated, and he went out of his way to do it. And tens or hundreds of thousands of educated people were slaughtered. It was as if ISIS had gone on a spree, but targeting the educated. So when you start looking at this whole idea of dismantling America, see, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I come from a family of signers of the Declaration of Independence. John Hart from New Jersey, and his family was totally decimated. And so we were always trained that, these aristocrats of 1776 never stopped attacking America. They're doing it this day. You look at the LIBOR scandal. You look at the stupid war that we've been going in the Middle East. This is all just to keep the British colonies alive. These guys have never stopped tricking America into fighting wars for them, and this whole idea that they've then set up, you know, the Klan are direct ties to the British. The British convinced the Confederacy to break away, and they left the Klan as saboteurs after the
thing.
Wow,
that's quite a conspiracy theory. So before I listen, I got to have to go in a second, Dave. That's quite interesting. Where do you come down on the election coming up? You've got a primary in California.
Well, we've got to have the truth, yeah. So we've got to have the truth. And we have to know whether or not we have a future. See, basically, if you start looking at these economic games that they keep playing, mm-hmm. why did we have to retrain five times, but that they tricked us into going with bad technology, and they tricked us into losing our...
I'll be honest with you, Dave, I'm not sure, when you say five times, I'm not sure what you mean by five times of retraining
In Jimmy Carter's term, at the end of Ford, Jimmy Carter, there was massive layoffs in the farming sector. It wasn't just automation, but it was also the corporate takeover of America's farms, and that was how the whole Jennings, Save America's
Corporate farming became huge at that time. Yeah,
that was massive. Then you had Ronald Reagan. We had the savings and loans collapse, and we had the economic collapse, and the rise of robots, and the rise of automation.
It's basically just a continuing process. By the way, thanks for the call. I got to let you go, David. At this point, very interesting call. Yeah, continuing process, obviously, for more and more automation in different industries. I don't would say five times. I mean, depending on where you were working, you might have had to change careers. You might not have been able, and generally, the change was for the worse. Not always, not invariably. Some people make out spectacularly well when there are disruptions, but most people find their lives aren't quite what they were hoping they would be, quite what they expected they'd be. All right, phone number 844-4HELG. Give me a call. Yeah, again, when you're a hammer, really, every problem looks like a nail. The professor, the college president sees the problem we have is education. We have to do a better job educating Dr. Roth, Professor Roth, Joe, President Roth, educate, what is it again? Cooperate. I'll never remember this. Animate, liberate, animate, cooperate, instigate. There you go. That is not enough. It's not enough. And I guess I have my little lenses, which is basically tax. And I've always said, never stop saying it. Tax the bads, not the goods. I'll get to that perhaps after this break. And it's also part of the discussion of the reunion. 844-4-HELG. 844-367-4254. Yeah, let's do the Media Matters. I don't think I need to do another clip, another song. But we can do Media Matters right here. I'll be back in a minute.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Following the Department of Labor's new overtime rules, which expand outdated overtime pay protections for millions of American workers, Fox Business contributor Elizabeth McDonald and host Stuart Varney predictably claimed the new rules could potentially destroy jobs.
What's this going to cost business?
So $12 billion over the next decade. That's what the Labor Department says. The overtime kicks in if you make about $47,500 and you work more than 40 hours a week, you will get overtime now. According to these new rules, who does it hit? Retail, restaurant, businesses. They make a lot, create a lot of the jobs in this country. So what could happen? Will the guys who run these businesses say, you know what, I'm going to keep my overhead the same? Because it could have cost jobs.
However, economist Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities praised the overtime update, stating that it will have a negligible impact on profits while encouraging job growth. And research from the Economic Policy Institute found that 12.5 million workers will directly benefit from the expanded overtime protections. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
All right, back on the Ginsburg Show. Let me just give you the number from Wall Street. Dow at 4.3 to 70,504, basically flat. S&P 500 up a fraction of a point to 2,053. NASDAQ up 12 and change. So it has the biggest jump of the morning to 47.82. Gold's down $7.30 an ounce to $1,245.60. Oil is down 98 cents a barrel, currently priced at $47.43. Yeah, I was, I threw out that figure, 3 million murdered by Pol Pot. For some reason, that number was in my mind. Not quite that many slaughtered during his regime, but it was bad enough. About 1 million people, according to the website mountholyoke.edu. So I guess they have some scholars at that very, very fine college who have studied the Vietnam War and the aftermath and what happened specifically in Cambodia. So about 1 million, and that's one-seventh of the population. So about 7 million Cambodians lived there in the early 70s. 1 million were killed. And it was, as David said, by the way, the intellectuals, the intelligentsia and city dwellers were the ones who were targeted and killed. All right, 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. This is what happens, by the way, when you have terrible economic injustice. Extremists take power. Generally, the history in the West, excluding Russia, I don't know if you call this Russia count as the West. The history in the West has often been right-wing extremists take power. The Nazis in Germany, the fascists in Italy, in Spain, Franco won in the 30s. So our experience in the last century, last millennium, last century, last millennium. So the general trend, at least in the West, has been that when you have rampant inequality, terrible injustice, the right wing is often the one that seizes power and undermines democracy. Could have happened in this country in the 30s. Instead, we did have, I guess you'd call him, I think, fairly enough, the democratic socialist, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who saved our democracy and saved capitalism too, ironically. I went from the lecture given by President Roth to lunch. But then after lunch, it was very nice, by the way, great catching up with people. And again, some folks, I was really taken by that. You see that split. People who went into finance, consulting, tending to be very, very well off. And of course, nobody asked for their salaries, but you can tell where people say they live. Do they live on, Park Avenue? Or do they live in Queens? That kind of tells you a lot. And the general sense I got was either people were doing extremely well or struggling. It's really interesting. And you could be a lawyer, and even a corporate lawyer, but if you don't have the clients, if your firm is struggling, if you get a bad rep at your firm, and the cost of living in Manhattan is so tremendous that really only that group at the very, very top, the folks making the seven figures. I don't cry for somebody who's making a few hundred thousand. It's a lot more than I make. But the point is that the society has become so distorted. And this is true in San Francisco, too, where the price of apartments, housing in the Bay Area is so incredible that even folks who are close to the 1% in income, they don't feel rich. I mean, no one feels rich. The richest don't feel rich. I'm sure Marissa Meyer looks at that $36 million she took home for losing $4.4 billion of tax of shareholder value. She's probably saying, I'm not making as much as, the Google guys. I'm sure she's saying that. But when I say in New York they don't feel rich, because they're living in the apartments aren't that big. They don't have a lot of space. If they don't have a house in the Hamptons, then, you're second rate. That is a real sentiment. So the distortion of the society, it just pushes people. A tiny number of people making extraordinary, beyond their wildest dreams, amounts of money, pushes everyone to kind of go for that brass ring, to take huge risks. And sometimes, and do things that are clearly not in our best interest, and makes a lot of people really unhappy. So Professor Roth, Dr. Roth, Michael, did I call him Joe? I know Joe Roth, right? Michael. President Roth's solution is this education model. Interestingly enough, I don't think that solves the problem. I think the problem is that the society, the economically distorted society has caused a perversion within the university itself. So there is this. And I know a lot of people say, well, it's always like that, Hal. It's always been like that. There's no change. This is the way. They're always glad-handing. I don't think so. I think it's worse today. I really do. I think there's more kowtowing. That's not the word I want to use. But there's more sort of deferring. There's more deference than ever given to the rich. I think that the subservience has reached new levels. I just believe that. 844, can I prove it? Probably, although I'm not going to try right now. 844-367-4254 if you want to join me. I went to a lecture on climate change. And I guess, you know, again, whether if you're a hammer, every problem's a nail. If you're a Democrat, if you worked for, if you were a staffer on a Democratic senator's team, then for you, every problem is a Republican. And I agree that Republicans are a huge part of the problem. The major part of the problem politically in America today is Republicanism. Its influence, its reach. Just as I agree with President Roth that we do need to educate our kids better, and we do need to train people and teach people and liberate them to really question every assumption that's made in society. But it's not enough. Just as it's easy enough if you're a Democrat, if you're a progressive, going to a liberal arts college to just say, oh, those Republicans, they're the fault. They cause all of our problems. And we could just get rid of them. All, everything would be so beautiful. And this came up when this staffer, who's now, I guess he does work currently. No, he's at the State Department. And he was going on about, he's an environmentalist. He works for, you know, an environmental subcommittee at the State Department. And there was a professor there, an economics professor. And, of course, you know, I love economics. That, to me, you really just need to study economics to solve our problems, especially tax policy. Tax the bads, not the goods. And the professor went first. He was great, Professor Yowie. So then this younger man from the State Department began to talk about how terrible Trump is, and Trump is a global warming denier. And then if he becomes elected, then all bets are off. And this was following the professor's presentation, Professor Yowie's presentation on Paris, on the COP21, the community of parties where they all got together in Paris last year, right? It was 2015, wasn't it? Wasn't Paris 2015? I think it was. And agreed on targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions throughout the world. And the rich countries have to help the poor countries. And this was just an astonishing event, and a lot of good came out. I'm not as optimistic as some, because I think it's easy to go to a meeting. It's easy to go to Paris, and you know, everyone's had some wine, and you all want to get along. We all realize how bad things are. You know, we like to go to Gstaad, but there won't be any more skiing if the planet keeps getting hotter and hotter. So how do we solve that? How do we save that? So I'm not quite as optimistic as some, but still, it's nice. It's good. And so this State Department employee comes on and he says, well, the problem is, and he's right, that one of the two major party candidates has a pretty darn good chance of winning. Trump doesn't even acknowledge there's such a thing as global warming. And it's the whole party that isn't complete, deep denial. And I said, you know, I made a point. I said, you're right. It's really, really scary. But don't you think that it's not enough to simply demonize Republicans? We have to recognize that the Democratic Party is complicit too. And these free trade deals like the TPP, which the president is pushing, have exacerbated global warming. And if the TPP is passed, it will make things even worse. And the military interventions in the Middle East are making matters worse. And he got mad. He just got angry. And he said, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And the president wants clean, green container ships that are natural gas powered, not these, you know. And I said, well, you got these filthy diesel ships that are belching plumes of diesel all the way across the Pacific. Oh, well, we're working on this problem. And he got really furious. And, of course, part of that is just naked partisanship, but part of it is, again, if you're a hammer, if you're a Democratic staffer at the State Department, then every problem is a Republican. If you're a hammer, every problem is a nail that you just bash in. And this kind of mindset doesn't solve our problems, A. It only pits us against each other where we're really fighting the wrong problem. If you think that every problem is a Republican, then you're not going to be fighting global warming. You're going to be fighting Republicans. And you're not going to be looking for ways to enlist them in the solutions. All right, let's go to the phones. Got another call. I think this is this a different San Francisco-based caller, I think? Or is this you again, David? Good morning.
Hello.
Hi, who's calling?
Morning.
Good morning. Who do I have? Hello?
Ron. It's Ron.
Ron, good to talk to you. First time caller? You don't sound familiar to me.
Well, I might have called before. I know I've called in regards to Santa Cruz. I'm out of San Francisco in Novato and Hamilton, which is a former military base.
Okay.
And my concern in your discussion going back to the toxins, not only in the environment, but in the consumer products, and not that they're regulated properly. When you talk about regulations, they're at certain levels, and they don't account for the lower levels that bioaccumulate. So when we talk about environment and consumer products, we're talking about so much out there, regulated and unregulated chemicals, what goes into consumer products, that when we get something to establish a regulation, we're not talking about all the other constituents, all the other toxic substances and chemicals that interact, that bioaccumulate in the human population and eventually triggering disease and cancer.
Well, that's really interesting. Ron, you're a little, Ron, let me interrupt you for a second. You're a little bit off my topic, but I'm prepared to go down this road for a bit with you. How come you decided, why is this what you want to talk about right this moment? Was there a news
story? Because politically, we need to, as a population, have the awareness so we can stimulate the real questions of concern that affect not only our immediate health, but the long-range health of the entire population.
How would you do that? How would you stimulate this kind of understanding among the populace? And are you, and can you give us an example? I mean, what you're saying is certainly familiar to me, this idea that, you know, for example, the nicotinoids, as I understand it, in the various what do they call them now, these GMOs, the genetically modified organisms they use for food, these seeds that they Monsanto has spread, they have the little nicotinoid gene in them.
You're talking correctly.
And it kills the bees and also it probably accumulates in our system as well. So is that a story on your mind? So how would you change, get people to understand this and maybe do we need a law change? Do we need to change the law so this does, you know, companies can't do this?
Well, no, the problem, let me be very basic here. When you're talking the bioaccumulation of toxic substances from all sources in human beings, those that can cause disease and stimulate cancers, not in 1 year, but in 10, 20, 30, even 50 years. It's like a long-range cigarette smoker that bioaccumulates the toxins from the cigarettes. In fact, in the 90s, I saw a report, which was a draft from the Surgeon General on dioxins in cigarettes. The final result of that in the report was it was extracted. It was taken out. There wasn't in there about cigarettes. That's just one source of contamination. How long is it going to take before the humans can no longer resist this, and the condition of health in the major part population is so defective that life expectancy is affected? And when you're talking about that, you're talking about something that simple. If we turn it around and prevent a lot of the bioaccumulation within the human bodies, we would reduce health care costs
considerably.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Ron.
Prevent the disease.
Ron, are you an expert in this field? You sound very knowledgeable, or is you're a dilettante.
I'm a concerned citizen. It goes back with experts, with people who had boots on the ground in relationship to this. So the best qualification I can give is I'm a concerned citizen.
Are there candidates for office that you support whom you believe will be champions in the fight against?
I have not, sir, heard one candidate really get down to the focus that we need a prevention of bioaccumulative toxins from all sources, where we can prevent the extreme of their distribution and prevent them in place in consumer products that go untold because they're below regulation levels.
Are you concerned that because of global warming, this problem will become exacerbated? After all, the one of the real growth areas in the field in botany is coming up with plants that are drought resistant. So this is a response and heat resistant, right? Heat and drought resistant.
No, sir, you can go anywhere within the field of production of food, environment, and everything else. The simple thing is that every day new chemicals, new mixtures, new interacting substances are created and used environmentally, and some are added to consumer products.
And before I let you go, Ron, very interesting, very scary. Do you have a solution, and do you have a website that you refer people to? Because I'm curious about this, and you brought this to my attention, so I'm going to ask you a solution and a website.
Solutions are not made, and students will be those in websites, and they'll be coming up under hopeandbeyond.org as we eventually process it.
All right,
the next
hope,
for the
hope and beyond. By the way, thank you for the call. I'm glad you found me. That's
thank
Ron
you.
In the Bay Area of San Francisco. By the way, San Francisco, not a happy place. No, well, at least if you're a basketball fan, right? What a blowout loss yesterday in Oklahoma City. I mean, was that just ugly? I think it was over 40 points at times, wasn't it? And I think they ultimately lost by 30. So that was, I was surprised. I thought for sure Golden State was going to roll. I know they lost that first game, right, in Oakland at the Oracle, but then they came back. We're talking about the NBA Western Conference Finals right now. And triggered in my mind two calls from San Francisco area. Earlier in the show, we had David and then Ron. First time call, I believe. So I'm thinking about San Francisco, and there were two games involving San Francisco teams that were on concurrently last night. I went back and forth between them, but ultimately settled on the one that led to a victory that resulted in a San Francisco team victory. So I watched the end, of course, of the Giants game. That was a great game. Thinking of you, too, my good friend in Aptos, Larry. Because I remember the last time Larry and I talked, last week, he was going on about how Bumgarner was just unhittable. He was on a roll. He knew, Larry did, that the Giants were going to win. And that's kind of how I felt last night. There was no way the Cubbies, team with the best record in baseball, was going to get to Bum. And they didn't. If they didn't get to him the first team, they weren't going to. He is really predictable. His worst innings are his first innings. And if he gets through those, he usually is just lights out. And he was last night. They still could have lost, though. The only run came courtesy of Bumgarner's double. And it was a blast. Deep center field, driving in a run. That was enough. They won 1-0. Great pitcher's duel last night. The basketball game, awful. I mean, it was, if you're a Warriors fan, it wasn't. In fact, if you're a fan at all, unless you're a Oklahoma City fan, it was a nightmare of a game. Oklahoma City, by the way, winning by 28 in the end, but that really understates how significant the blowout was. Again, I think there were times in that game that the Thunder were up by over 40 points. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it only got to about 39. I remember 39. 844-4-HELL-G if you want to join me. Actually, it's almost 10. East Coast, that would make it 7 Pacific. You can do the math if you're in between. We do have the Thought Wrestler coming up to start the next hour. My good friend Danny Cardwell in the Shenandoah. And we'll be talking presidential politics with Danny. I kind of avoided that. But I think the second, third of the show will really focus on the Democratic side and what we need to do to thump Trump. What do we need to do? That's coming up. Before I hit the break, I also want to respond here briefly, maybe I'll talk about it a little bit more, from Jeff in Columbus. The irony, Hal, you're talking about people who see every problem as a nail because they're hammers. So the academic, the college president sees every problem as one of simply improving education. If we just do improve our educational system, everybody will be happy. And the State Department Democratic staffer sees every problem as Republicanism. Jeff writes to me, since you see every problem being a result of economic injustice, what kind of hammer are you? Well, you know, Jeff, I think that's a fair question, and I've thought a lot about that. But economic injustice is a problem. So it's a problem we have to solve. And so I do have a kind of a penchant for a bent towards economics and tax policy, I guess. So I guess you'd say, well, yeah, my hammer would be tax policy. And I keep saying that. Let's tax the bads, not the goods. Professor Yoey, the economics professor, there's a surprise. He agreed with me. He said, yeah, you got it right, Ginsburg. You know what we need to do? He didn't use my name. He didn't know my name, but I'm going to email him. He said, we need to tax carbon. We need to tax fossil fuels. That is the solution. We need to tax the bads. That's how we will address climate change. But I'm, you know, hey, I'm willing to listen. If there are other issues, you know, if there are other solutions that people have, and if you've got them, Jeff, I'm more than happy to listen. If you think there are other ways to address poverty, to address the bioaccumulation in our systems, which Ron was talking about, please let me know, because I'm happy for us to work together to solve these problems. All right, 844-4-HELL-G. Let's go to our break. We'll come back. We'll go to the president now. Let's look at the president's weekly address, right? Because he does that weekly address on Saturdays. It's posted. So let's listen to the president. We'll come back to the thought wrestler. We're going to talk about the Democrats and what we need to do, how we can unite, and how we can, and what we need to do, and why we need to do it to defeat Donald Trump.
Hi, everybody. Last summer, I got a letter from a woman named Elizabeth Paredes from Tucson, Arizona. Elizabeth's the mom of a 3-year-old boy and an assistant manager at a sandwich shop. She earns about $2,000 a month, and she routinely works some 50 hours a week, sometimes even more. But because of outdated overtime regulations, she doesn't have to be paid a dime of overtime. She wrote, "It's not easy work, and it requires a lot of time away from my son. At times I find it's not worth it." Things like the 40-hour work week and overtime are two of the most basic pillars of a middle-class life. But for all the changes we've seen in our economy, our overtime rules have only been updated once since the 1970s. Just once. In fact, 40 years ago, more than 60% of workers were eligible for overtime based on their salaries. But today, that number is down to 7%. Only 7% of full-time salaried workers are eligible for overtime based on their income. That's why this week, my administration took a step to help more workers get the overtime pay they've earned. The Department of Labor finalized a rule to extend overtime protections to 4.2 million more Americans. It's a move that will boost wages for working Americans by $12 billion over the next 10 years. We're more than doubling the overtime salary threshold. And what that means is most salaried workers who earn less than about $47,500 a year will qualify for overtime. Or their employers can choose to give them a raise so that they earn more than $47,500. Or if employers don't want to raise wages, they can let them go home after 40 hours and see their families or train for new jobs. Any way you slice it, it's a win for working families. And we're making sure that every 3 years, there will be an automatic update to this threshold so that working families won't fall through the cracks for decades at a time ever again. This is the single biggest step I can take through executive action to raise wages for the American people. It means that millions of hardworking Americans like Elizabeth will either get paid for working more than 40 hours or they'll get more time with their families. Either way, they win. The middle class wins, and America wins. We still have more work to do to make sure this economy works for everybody, not just those at the top. That's why I'll never stop fighting for as long as I hold this office to restore the sense that in America, hard work should be rewarded with the chance to get ahead. Thanks, everybody, and have a great weekend.
He sort of abruptly ended that, Danny, the Thought Wrestler with me, Danny Carwell, thoughtwrestler.blogspot.com. Also, he blogs, Danny does, not President Obama, at dagblog.com. And, you know, all the other clips I play, like the environmental news and stuff, they have music that ends, but the president says, thank you very much, and he's gone, and it's, it always takes me by surprise. I'm going to have to email him and say, you know, come on, put some music on there, Hail to the Chief or something. Make life easier for me. Good morning, Danny. How you doing?
Good morning, Hal, and good morning to all your listeners. I'm doing well, and I hope everyone in the audience is doing well as well.
You enjoyed my conversation about the reunion you told me during the break, and you wanted to just kind of add some thoughts. So please do. And thank you for the compliment, by the way.
Well, you know, I think you're right. Some of the solutions, and all of us have these blind spots where we see a particular problem from where we stand, and so we analyze that problem from our perspective, and we apply solutions to that problem based on our experiences and our expertise or the field of knowledge that we're most comfortable in. And so there are social issues that have their roots in maybe economic disparities but are sometimes viewed through racial lenses. There are problems that have racial roots that are sometimes viewed through the lens of economic lenses. And then there are political problems that have their roots in overall sociological interactions between people, social hierarchy. So one of the telltale traits of the last 100 years is that some of the scholars and academics that we, you know, that the left looked to for solutions, some of them are multidisciplined in the sense that there are economists who have a much better understanding of social interactions between groups of people than, say, some of the sociologists. And there are sociologists who have better understanding of the way that economics, finance, and power can affect people than some of the people in those fields. So, you know, I think that we need a multidisciplined look, an honest multidisciplined look at some of the problems that we face as Americans.
Is that possible? Because the forces that want us not to solve problems seem at this time, at least as far as I can see it, Danny, be a lot stronger. I mean, they're concentrated. They've got more power. They got more money, and they don't want us to come together in a multidisciplined way to solve problems.
No, I mean, and that's real. We have people. We have a status quo that the left and the right benefit from in a way that, you know, causes large-scale moves and shifts to, you know, be almost impossible at times. And so, you know, it's up to the demos, it's up to the people, it's up to us to push these issues. And we have tools that are available to us now that we could better use. And yet, we're so separated and so far apart that, you know, maybe 200 years ago, a pamphlet can have more power than a tweet. Even though the pamphlet would reach a fraction of the people that, you know, the most popular person on Twitter can reach with 140 characters. So it's an interesting dynamic that we're forced to deal with.
Well, you made a very interesting point in a previous show and in a previous posting that all that technology that can be used to broadcast to millions or even billions of people as much as pulling us together tears us apart, right? I mean, this gives us the opportunity to only interact with people who agree with us and to have groupthink where someone, and by the way, we see this at the blog where we both post at Dad Blog. There really does seem to me, you can disagree, to be posses of people who together gang up like a flock of crows attacking an intruder who doesn't share their view. And rather than, therefore, the technology being a way for us to work together to increase our mutual understanding, it's a way to reinforce one particular view and to exclude all others.
But there is a lot of that. You know, we see these cyber cliques that have formed, and you know, it doesn't help push our agenda. It doesn't help solve problems. There's a small-mindedness in that kind of thinking, and I think that for the year and a half that I've been associated with Dag Blog, I've seen you become the, you know, you have...
I'm the scapegoat!
You have definitely made some political adversaries in the center and some on the left.
But what's frustrating is the idea, and I'm sure I'm responsible for this more than anybody, that I'm not able to persuade people to reconsider their assumptions. That's what frustrates me more than anything else. And when I attempt to get people to reconsider their assumptions, they get angrier rather than acknowledge that they failed in that endeavor. And I find that extremely upsetting and frustrating and annoying. And the antithesis of what, you know, I think what mutual education should be about.
Well, that's how sometimes we get our politics invested. We get so emotionally invested in our beliefs and our stances that, you know, even myself, I mean, we don't allow some of the evidence that could, you know, sway contrary to our long-held beliefs to enter into the equation. And so it is a narrowing. I mean, but, you know, human beings are susceptible to that. You can have couples that love each other very much and can have arguments based on facts and data, and yet, you know, doesn't reflect in the conversations, doesn't reflect in the solutions. So, you know, all of us hold that. And then all of us start from a different place. We all start from a different place, whether it's educationally or the way we view the world. And so there are issues that maybe, you know, a woman on the left is more sensitive to than a man on the left. There are issues that someone from the South understands and sees differently than someone from the North. And so it's hard to navigate those divides sometimes because we get so emotionally attached to our position. And it goes back to the whole discussion of, you know, every solution looking like a nail when you're a hammer. I mean, I think that all of us have some of that built into us. How genuine we are in the fight against it is what ultimately determines our outcomes.
All right, I want to get to your column here that you just posted. I'm tired of defending Hillary Clinton. And you start by writing, in the last few months, I felt compelled to defend Hillary Clinton. I guess why? Why do you feel, you know, and some would say that I feel compelled to criticize her. Maybe I do, but I can answer that question. I'm coming around. I'm going through my five stages of grief. And I will get to acceptance. I'm partly at acceptance. But I felt compelled to criticize her because I wanted people to support her Democratic primary opponent. I thought he would be, I think he will be, he would be a better president. Why do you feel compelled to defend her?
At this point in the contest, you know, the accusations, any accusations, whether true, false, personal, or, you know, professional, any of those critiques and any of the accusations made against the secretary were all fair game while the contest was in the heat of the battle. The moment that there was a certain sense of inevitability, that was when I felt like, you know, some of the attacks should have let up. Going into the heat of battle, whatever strategy someone employs, you know, that's something that they're going to have to live with in themselves. You know yourself some of the tactics that the right has used over the course of the last 30 years doing elections have been brutal. But it was calculated decisions that they felt like they needed to use to win. And so I'm not standing on some high moral perch saying that any of these candidates should be, you know, excluded from the scrutiny or the nastiness of politics. My whole defense has started in the last few months once it's become almost, you know, inevitable that she would be the nominee. At this point, none of those things are doing anything to change the tide. If you wanted to September go after her for anything, it wouldn't have mattered. It you know, it would have all been fair game, but now it just seems awful late in the game to still keep throwing Hail Marys. And, you know, one of the Hail Marys or one of the haymakers could land. I mean, what if you get to this stage in the game and you knock out someone that is legitimately going to be the candidate? I mean, you know, fighting from the left and the right, and I don't know that fighting on two fronts at this stage in the game is beneficial to keeping Donald Trump out of the White House.
I think what a lot of people, and I've written about this quite a bit, I think what a lot of progressives are most frustrated about at this point is a sense that Clinton doesn't get it. She doesn't get, I mean, she will get the nomination, but she doesn't get, it seems, why there's so much, people are so upset, why there's so much discontent in society today, why Bernie Sanders almost beat her. She doesn't get why there's people distrust her. I mean, she was asked that very question. You know, why do you think so many Americans don't trust you? And she said, well, I've always tried to be honest. And that's just not responsive. It seems as though she's incapable, perhaps, of self-reflection. And I would argue that that failure on her part, or that inability, could doom her in November. So the criticism could be beneficial. You're saying it's only harmful. But I would say that if the criticism causes her to reflect on how she's spoken to people in the past, how she has, you know, steadfastly refused to, for example, make public her Goldman Sachs speeches, or even to understand why it seems, the sense I get from her is she resents the idea, the implication that she could be bought and paid for by big bankers. If she reconsiders that view now and starts talking with genuine understanding why so many people really have great concerns about her, rather than only blaming it on the vast right-wing conspiracy, which I agree exists. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. But that vast right-wing conspiracy hasn't caused people to have such high disfavorability or unfavorable views of President Obama. He is popular right now. It seems as though the discontent and distrust of Clinton goes beyond simply media, unfavorable media coverage. And so I'm saying is that perhaps one benefit from continuing to criticize her is to get her, and frankly, her supporters to say, yeah, you know what? She is flawed. She's not ideal. And for her to say, I know, in the past, maybe some of the policies I followed really weren't conducive to making America a better place. And I think that would make her much more likely. You want to win in November. You want to defeat Trump. Well, I do too. This is how I think we defeat Trump.
Well, I mean, I think those are all valid arguments, but there's Hillary Clinton, she's a paradox in the sense that how many years in a row has she been the most admired woman in America? So she's the most admired woman in America, and she's not trusted. And I don't know that if a person can occupy that same space and be the same person. Now, a person and their caricature can do that. But I just don't know how that. I just, in my mind, I can't put that together.
Well, let me try. Let me get Larry on real quick. But I'll stick with you. I just want to get him on so he can hear the way this works. Larry, hold for a second. We'll get to you in a moment. But I do want to respond. Well, I guess the answer is this: in 2015, 13% of Americans said that Hillary Clinton was the woman they most admired. So only 13%. But the vote was split with number 2 Malala, 3 Oprah Winfrey, Michelle Obama coming in 4th. You had Carly Fiorina, Queen Elizabeth. So there's a lot of women who are mentioned. That would, to my way of thinking, say, okay, there's a very significant minority of Americans who have great admiration for Hillary Clinton. But in fact, a majority of Americans don't think favorably about her.
It's just Hillary Clinton presents a paradox in that sense, though. I mean, you know, for 17 or 18 years, I don't know how many, I mean, it's been since the
20th time, it says, according to Gallup,
the 20th time. Yeah, so, I mean, for 20 years, okay, you have a public spotlight, you have a public figure that has been in the news for, you know, 3 decades. And so she has garnered that sort of support. She's been in there, and you bring up a good point about the plurality of that support. It's a split field. But at the same time, the majority, if 67% or 70% of people don't trust her, we're saying that in these polls, we're looking at these internal metrics that are used to cover these polls, we're saying that almost 7 in 10 Americans don't trust her. And yet...
But only 13% say she's the most admired, the woman they most admire. By the way, I think the latest poll, well, I just popped this up, about 60%. I don't think it's quite 70% who don't trust Clinton. It's about 60%. It's very, very high. It's a very high percentage. But the 40% who don't, who do trust her, who don't distrust her, the 40% who trust her, of that group, I'm sure you'd find every single one of the 13% of Americans who say she's the woman they most admire. So she is polarizing. She's viewed with great affection and respect and admiration by a significant number, but many more don't feel that way about her. I don't think it's that to me doesn't shock me. I mean, you probably would find President Obama is the most admired and the most disliked American right now if you did a poll.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that polarization, that schism, that split is kind of indicative of the electorate and where we are and the way we see some of the problems and issues that we have. I've said before, I didn't start defending Hillary Clinton. I didn't support her in 2008. She was not the candidate that I would have chosen in 2016. But this is the car we're driving. And, you know, this is these... You know, this is where we are, and I think the list that Donald Trump submitted of his prospective jurists for the Supreme Court, you know, should be what rallies the left more so than rallying the right.
Well, that's what Clinton said. She said what unites us is our shared dislike of Donald Trump, and I think that's so sad. Isn't that so sad, Danny? Shouldn't what unites us be a vision for a better America, one where we don't have 20% of our children or 25% of our children living in poverty? Shouldn't what unites us be a shared vision that we're going to clean up our world and leave it in a healthier, more vibrant, more biodiverse planet than we came onto it? I mean, it seems to me there are many great goals that we could rally around as a nation. Shouldn't what unites us be a shared view that every American, when sick, when injured, should have health care that does not cost them out of pocket anything at all or anything beyond what they can afford? And yet that's not where we are. I mean, that's what I think is so unfortunate about this entire... Now, I'm not saying it's all Hillary Clinton's fault, but I'm saying that is where we are right now.
Well, you brought up three important issues. You brought up income inequality, the fact that so many children live in poverty. You brought up environmental status of the planet, global warming and pollution. And then you talked about...
I forget, too, what I talked about. But, I think health care. Healthcare was number three. Healthcare was...
Okay.
But I forget myself within a few moments.
So... we've got three issues that you talked about, and how much difference is it between the candidates that we had on the left and the candidates on the right? Now, we may vary in ways to get there, but, I mean, is there someone that really thinks that, you know, the environmental issues, that any of the Republicans were better on the environmental issues than the left was?
No, I agree with you. I agree with you, she's better. But again, she's not able to rally us. And I think part of it is because she is compromised. She has been compromised by big money. You know, we talk about poverty. Well, look at who she goes to speak to. She doesn't go to speak to poor kids. She goes to speak to billionaire bankers.
Well, now, let's not just completely say that she doesn't go speak to poor kids, because she goes and panders every 4 years, like every Democrat
But
does.
You know what I'm saying. But you see what I'm saying. But then she won't let us know what she said to the bankers.
Here's the thing.
Go ahead.
I don't hold her to a higher standard than I hold other Democrats, because I would have taken the money. If Goldman Sachs sends me a check right now and says, we need you in Manhattan corporate office to give a speech, I would do it in a heartbeat. And whatever I say to them, I would do it. And that's just the nature of that is our nature. That is my flawed nature as a person.
I don't believe, but would you keep it secret? Would you keep what you said from the American people?
Oh, she's probably pandered to them in a way, and moving capital through markets and the way you've innovated finance. She probably said a bunch of things.
Well, but then
don't you think with the American worker?
And you don't think that should be something that Americans are very... Now, look, I will vote for her, as I've said. I mean, you're saying we hold her to a different standard, a higher standard. I don't think I do. I'm not going to vote for Trump, because all the issues that you raise about Clinton, I agree. Trump is worse. His rhetoric is worse than hers is. And he is secretive, too, and he has these tax returns he won't publicize, and I think that's a big problem also. So I'm not saying I don't hold... you're saying people hold her different, a higher standard, and maybe some do, but I won't vote for Trump for many of the same reasons I'm skeptical of Clinton. But I think we have a right to criticize her when she says that she's on our side, and point out that it's going to be tough to get her for her to rally us to fighting economic injustice when she gives these $220,000 speeches, gets that kind of money, and then won't even tell us what she said. I mean, you don't think that's a legitimate criticism?
No, I do. I think, again, all of the criticisms are worthy. All the criticisms, there was a time and place for her to be drugged through the proverbial mud. And I think that time has maybe ended, because, you know, we're here, November, 6 months away. And she will be attacked viciously. There's a right-wing machine that's been in place for 3 decades that will attack her viciously. And so if she is to win this nomination, there was a contested and a heavily heated contest that they ran. She almost lost to Bernie Sanders. Had Bernie Sanders started 4 or 5 years earlier, reaching to the South, reaching out to black voters, this could have turned around, but none of that happened. And we are where we are. Like, reflexively looking back on what could have been is not going to change anything.
Agreed. I totally agree with that.
Again,
I agree. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, the Donald Trump list of prospective jurists isn't something that, you know, again, I want to make sure I clear this up. It's not that we unite against him because he's so bad. I mean, that list of jurists should have been the clarion call to the left. This is what he intends to do. And there's not a unanimous pick on that of those jurists that he's made. I mean, Merrick Garland wasn't far enough to the left for some progressives. And there's no Merrick Garlands on that list.
Yeah, Merrick. I want to just be clear, too. I think Merrick Garland, from what I've read, and I don't, you know, I never met the man, but I think he was a good choice by the president. I think it's outrageous that he hasn't been approved. And not only that, Danny, I think that this should be a reason voters should vote Democratic. I think it's ironic, because you wrote, I'm tired of defending Hillary Clinton, and I feel like I'm pressuring you to defend her. And I'm sorry, because you don't want to do that. And in fact, I wanted to talk about how together we can help get her elected, but maybe we don't even agree on that. But before, let's get Larry on. Larry has been waiting very patiently in Aptos. Thank you for waiting, Larry. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Hal. Yeah, I've got a few comments, and, you know, this discussion continues about whether Clinton is worthy of our votes or not, and, you know, I just have to say at the top, I mean, I would only vote for her to keep Trump out of the White House, and, I'm here in California. I could safely throw away my vote and vote for Jill Stein, but I don't trust that. I would rather vote for her anyway, even though Clinton more than likely would win California over Trump and by a good margin. But he stands to win the whole entire Confederacy, ex-Confederacy, and some of the mountain states like Wyoming, Montana, perhaps, and some of the Rust Belt states. Maybe he's going to pluck off one of the New England states, I'm not sure. But he stands to make the race very close. And, I think that Clinton, she says she's not going to get down in the gutter with him, but I think she's got to, maybe mention in her speeches whenever his name's going to come up. She should say things like 4 times bankrupt Trump. Because the other day he called her Crooked Hillary again. So, it's fair play, right? I think she also, unfortunately, this is the thing about her. This is why a lot of people don't like her.
I'll tell you what she should call him. Let me just interrupt you. You said 4 times bankrupt. She should call him Deadbeat Donald. The Deadbeat Donald. That's what she should call him.
Donald would work, too.
The Deadbeat. Well, it's a lot pithier, right? It's a lot shorter than 4 times. Just call him the Deadbeat Donald. And then after a while, you just call him Deadbeat. I mean, I'm happy to have this conversation. Let's come up with ways to beat Trump. Because I think that's where you want to go, right, Danny? Is how do we beat this guy?
I think one of the, at some point, Hillary Clinton has to address in a forceful and strong way the concerns that many progressives have with her, whether those concerns are founded in reality or not. And some of them have legitimate legs and claims. Some of them are fantasy images created by the character of Hillary Clinton. But she has to speak to those issues. She has to do so in a sincere and forceful way. Secondly, though, we have to come together in some sort of way as a party and understand that this 2016 election and the, not just the Supreme Court, but the federal court level, the number of justices that need to be replaced. I mean, we're going to legislate in a sense. We have a chance to correct some of the legislation at the state level that has done harm to some of the most innocent and some of the most helpless people in our society, and this is important.
I agree with you, Danny. I so agree with that, and I want Hillary to come out and talk about that. And maybe the part of the problem is when she does, we on the left don't hear it. And I think that is true. And I think there's some of that. I think we on the left are now so predisposed to be suspicious of her that we don't hear her, or we hear the qualifying words that she uses rather than the aspirations, which she does have to cut down on poverty, which she does have to increase healthcare availability, which she does have to clean up the environment. So I think that's true. And I think what you said is very valid, is that she needs to also reach out to us. It has to be a two-way street. And I'm there. Given her weakness in communicating, I think we all agree with that. She's gotta choose as a running mate someone who does talk persuasively, convincingly to the left. I think that's something she has to do. Now, again, I want her to win. I'm going to vote for her. There's no doubt about it. And I think, Deadbeat Donald's a good one. Larry, what do you think Clinton can do? I want to just go through these polls real quick because they're very, very frightening. And I had talked last week about how the polls that showed the Donald, Deadbeat Donald closing were right-wing polls. Fox, Rasmussen reports. Even CBS last week had Clinton up by 6. So that's not so bad for her. But polls that came out yesterday. These are scary polls. NBC, very credible pollster, obviously. Wall Street Journal, NBC, Clinton plus three. The ABC News, Washington Post, very credible pollster, right? Trump plus two. Trump beating Clinton, according to ABC News, Washington Post. In important states, it's basically a dead heat. In Virginia, the Roanoke College poll. I think that's not too far from you, right, Danny Roanoke?
About an hour and a half.
Clinton and Trump are tied. And that's a state you're afraid she could lose. That's an important state. That's a purple state. Florida, right now, Trump v. Clinton plus one, according to CBS News. Obviously a credible pollster. So this is very scary. It really is. And I'll just throw one other poll out there. And this I throw this out because it corroborates what I've said. I've argued in the past it's not certain that Sanders is stronger than Clinton, although he does better than she does in the general election polls matchups. In Florida, Clinton is up by one, according to CBS News, but Sanders is tied in Florida. So she's actually doing better, slightly better, and I think that goes to what I've said. Demographically, she is strongest with African-Americans, voters of color, generally, and specifically older voters, older women. And Florida is chock-a-block with older voters, older women, many widows. Women live longer than men, so many widows there. And also voters of color, Latinos, African-Americans. So Florida is the state, if you want to argue Clinton would be stronger in the general election, I would argue Florida, 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 Florida. All right, Larry, what can she
do? If I could say something about Florida really quickly, and that is Sanders made that statement about having a more even hand between Israel and Palestine. I'm sure that doesn't go down with a lot of older Jewish voters.
No question.
Older Jewish voters.
No question about that. You're absolutely right there as well.
Yeah, and in fact, even this Canova, who's running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, he wouldn't exactly back up Bernie's statement there.
No, he's very pro Zionist conservative Israel. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you got to go with the demographics in that state.
Yeah, but that's important, right? Because Florida is a crucial state. Florida is the most important swing state by far. By far the most important swing state, the largest swing state.
Yeah, so what I think the problem with Clinton, and it has been, is she's been around, you know, in the public eye for 20-some-odd years now. And there's a perception that, and it's true, she's from the upper middle class. She grew up a Republican. She grew up in a Republican household. And I'm not sure what she did exactly out of college. You know, she became a lawyer, obviously, got involved with Clinton while she was still in college, and very quickly in life became a governor's wife. And I think there's always a sense with people that she's sort of spoiled, pampered, that she's never really.
Well, she's not one of us. She's not one of us. And I'll tell you, Larry, I'm going to let you go with that because I really want to keep the focus on Danny. He's calling. He's taking his time. What about that? Is that accurate that for many, many Americans, the perception is she's not one of us?
That's a very valid perception. I mean, you know, one statement that even though it's, you know, it was based in facts, you know, when she left the White House talking about how they were broke, I can assure you that, you know, people that are broke, you know, they looked at that statement much differently than, you know, than it came off. And so, yeah, you know, they might have had outstanding liabilities, but you're leaving the White House with the potential to make, you know, millions of dollars or at least tens of thousands of dollars giving speeches before you would ever write a book. And that's a different financial situation than someone trying to figure out how, you know, to keep lights on next month. So, I mean, there is a disconnect that comes with, you know, some of her background.
But, of course, that is your double standard because look at Trump. Trump was born to even much greater wealth than Hillary.
Oh, yeah.
And one can argue, I think one can correctly argue that that Hillary, to a much greater extent, although she did with her husband, but together they built their success, whereas Trump pretty much inherited it. So that is a double standard. How then? But you know, Trump's vote. I read this article in Salon, Danny, where the writer said Trump is not, you know, working class, white working class voters don't view Trump as this elitist, even though he certainly economically is, financially is. How do we change that opinion? How do we change that view?
It never will change. Once someone, back to hammers and nails. I mean, once someone feels a certain way, you're not going to change that. So, yeah, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, the wealthiest of the wealthiest Rockefellers and the elites in this country, they've all been at the same cocktail parties. They've all been at the same weddings and functions. And, their children have gone to similar private schools. They all know each other. They've shared au pairs. And yet he's immune from the same sort of tagging that Hillary Clinton wouldn't be immune from. And so, it's never going to change. There are blue-collar people that see him as one of them and their aspirational hopes to be at the seat, to one day be at the great banquet, their aspirational hopes. They don't envision themselves as where they are. They envision themselves as where they want to be. And so they can identify with him as being one of them because he kind of tells it like, Chuck or Larry at the on the mill, when Chuck gets to talk, and that's kind of how he talks, or when Larry tells a joke, he kind of tells it like Donald. And so he's transcended that economic caste system or that disparity that you see some of the poor rural working class people have towards the wealthy. He's transcended that in a way that it's interesting. But,
how would you win? Because it sounds like you don't think the way to win is to try to turn at least some of his supporters against him. So what do you propose, Danny?
Strong voter turnout. And in the debates, Hillary Clinton, which Hillary Clinton, the Benghazi 11-hour hearing, the work that she's done in the debates against Bernie Sanders, she's formidable. She's held her own, and she's had a grasp of the facts that that I think that Donald Trump will not have. And in the debates, she just has to absolutely show unequivocally how unprepared he is. When he makes a misstep, when he contradicts himself, she has to be forceful, and she has to rally rational, like-minded people in the middle of the political spectrum that this man cannot be the president, because there's a certain percent of his base that's never going to leave him. I mean, they're never going to leave him. And so you almost have to give up on that. It's a fool's errand to waste time and resources trying to convince them. You have to reach to the middle. You have to unite the left, and you have to reach into the middle in the sense that you have to pull some of the more common-sense-minded folks into your camp.
Are you optimistic that this will happen? Do you think when she becomes the nominee and it does appear that President Obama will support her very strongly, will that be enough in your view?
I think so, because, we know where the electoral map starts out. We know that the race to 270 starts with a certain amount of givens, and you look at their negatives and their unfavorable ratings. The demographics, it would take an awful lot of election fraud, and I don't use that word lightly. It would take a lot of disenfranchisement in some purple states for Donald Trump to overcome the net negatives he has with people of color, with women. You have women make up 51-52% of the population, and 7 of 10 women view him unfavorably. I just don't know how you can... I read these polls and I see them, and I look at closely at their internal metrics, and you see the sampling and you see how they're brought down, and some of these polls just don't reflect the electorate the way it should.
All right, you're one African American. You're not speaking for all or even most or even a minority of African Americans, but certainly you have a better sense of the some African American communities than perhaps many of us do, including myself. Do you think there will be anywhere near the kind of enthusiasm And a number of, I mean, certainly percentage-wise, she'll win by an overwhelming majority in the general election. But will she get as many or close to as many African-American voters to the polls as President Obama was able to?
You know, I think that that relates to the level of disenfranchisement efforts we see. I mean, I don't think that people are going to wait in line 6 hours to vote for Hillary Clinton the way some did in Florida to vote for President Obama. So, no, and that's why these efforts need to start now. I mean, there need to be, you know, as the primary season went on, we saw the events that happened in Nevada. We saw some of the other, Arizona, as a matter of fact, they had a rough going. These issues need to be resolved now. There needs to be people on the left proactively, you know, looking at where were the problematic districts, you know, and how are we going to fix those, because I don't think that people are going to wait 4 hours for Hillary Clinton, and that's no slight on her. I just think it's the reality. It's, you know, these elections, we have not gotten better at elections. You would think after this many centuries of running elections in this country, we'd have gotten better, and we haven't. So demographically speaking, I don't know how the Republicans can win 270 electoral votes with the hand that they're currently holding.
All right, let me throw out what I've made a lot of various ways I think Hillary Clinton can go about winning this election, what she needs to do. Mention, you know, three areas, you know, economic disparities, wealth disparities, the environment, health care. I didn't mention this before, but I think, Danny, I want your thoughts. I think she just needs to be talking about jobs. You know, Bernie, take a cue from Sanders. Bernie gave the exact same stump speech throughout this country over and over and over again. He was very simple. He was very specific, and he just kept saying the same thing. If I were advising Hillary Clinton, I would say every time you go out there, you speak to large groups of people and talk about jobs, how you're going to bring good jobs, decent middle-class jobs to the region where you're speaking. Your thoughts?
No, I think that would be a very effective strategy to employ. And when you think about, you know, and I know that it's funny when we look at the South, because there are times when the left just completely discounts the South if, you know, the primaries didn't go in favor of Bernie. Then there are times when primary wins by Bernie were touted as a way of him opening the field and bringing in conservative voters to the party. But if we look at what's worked for both of them in the South, and it has been jobs issues. So West Virginia seemed like it was going to be a problematic for Hillary Clinton because of her statements about coal and the way that she inartfully described her plans to innovate, you know, the carbon emissions industry. But, you know, in the end, you're right. I think jobs, if people feel like they can provide for their family and you're giving them a reasonable, you know, expectation to do so, I think that that can bridge a lot of the divides that we've seen.
Yeah, I think she's just got to keep talking about it. I mean, it just can't be a one-off. It can't be, you know, say it in one place and then kind of pivot. It's got to be. And I do think, and this is where it gets to what I believe about the criticism. Part of the reason people, I think, do not fully trust her is because some of the policies she's championed in the past, the free trade deals, her husband's Glass-Steagall vote, which she is not, just she says she doesn't support a new Glass-Steagall. She doesn't support breaking up the big banks. And I think people hear that and they think she's really not on my side and she's really not there to try to create more jobs or recognize what caused the collapse, you know, in the 2000s. And really, even in the 90s, people thought, oh, what a great time that was. But for many, it wasn't such a good time. I think this is why the criticism has value, because if it can cause her to maybe get why so many people are unhappy and how she needs to respond to it, that would be a really good thing. I think it would help her win.
Well, and you know, we're in May. You know, November is 6 months, is going to go by fast. There has to be concessions made. But at the same time, you know, this can't just be a one-way street where, you know, the Sanders supporters are just expected to fall in line. But at the same time, Hillary can't be expected to run away from the things that, some of the things that put her over the top. We have more agreement than a lot of the Sanders supporters and a lot of the Clinton supporters are willing to admit. You know, when you talk about a voting record that was 93% in line with what Bernie Sanders had in the Senate, when you talk about the big issue items, you talked about, you know, health care, you talked about environment, you talk about jobs, you know, there's not that much space between the two. And then you talk about the Supreme Court. You know, I would trust Bernie Sanders to select Supreme Court justices. I would trust Hillary Clinton more than I trust any Republican to select Supreme Court justices. So on the big ticket issues, you know, the gap isn't as far as we've been led to believe. And I do believe that the trade deals in the past, I think that both of them have problematic votes in their past. But, you know, I don't know if I could comfortably hold Hillary Clinton to a standard that I don't hold past Democratic candidates to. I mean, everyone has votes that they maybe wish they could get back. How sincere is she in her apologies? I don't know. Hopefully it was sincere contrition and, you know, she's willing to look at those mistakes and move forward. Some of her foreign policy scares me only because she's affected by male patriarchy in a way that I don't even think she accepts. The fact that, you know, sometimes you might be the only woman or one of a few women in a room where tough decisions are being made. You know, you subconsciously or unconsciously fight the perception of being weak because you're a woman. And, you know, history's proven that. We've got a long list of patriarchal female leaders.
Let me ask this question. Do you think that may have played a role in some of the aggressiveness that we saw? I'm not saying, and President Obama was not nearly as aggressive as I fear Hillary Clinton might be, and she had called for him to take more interventionist positions, sometimes successfully, sometimes less so. But do you think there was maybe a fear in the Obama White House that the man with the funny-sounding, vaguely Arab-Muslim name couldn't be seen as too soft on the Arab world?
Well, I think that's an obstacle, that's a hurdle that Democrats for 35 years have had to hurdle. And so he had it doubly so, and I think that in some respects Hillary has had it doubly so. The moment, you know, the perception that the left is weak, the perception that, you know, the left is full of chicken hawks and appeasers. You know, that's been a narrative crafted over a couple decades that's been very successful. It's a very successful marketing tool. So you're already trying to hurdle that obstacle, and then you put, you know, another obstacle in the way of it. So, yeah, the fact that, you know, he to this day still seen as a Muslim sympathizer, a closet Muslim, and, you know, soft on terror, even though he's killed more terrorists than any president in the history of the country. I mean, you know, those are real things. So, yeah, I think they can cloud someone's judgment. I think they have clouded judgment. I think that some of the decisions we've made, you know, have those things resting at their roots.
All right, Danny, with us, the Thought Wrestler. And I forget, are you scheduled? I mean, I'm happy. I want to keep you through the hour. Is that the general schedule? Or we worked on an hour or half hour?
No, we've been doing a half hour, but this conversation has been going so good that I'm riding with you. But, you know, again, these issues are, all these issues are very important. And, you know, arbitrarily setting a timetable to try to discuss it doesn't work.
All right, let's go to the reunion. And let me go full circle. Because one of President Roth has really focused in on outreach to students from disadvantaged backgrounds and to making sure that promising students who have great potential have an opportunity to attend the school. And also have their tuition needs and even beyond met so that they're not simply kind of in their own little less privileged world. One of the issues he discussed was the lack of preparation that some of these students who clearly are extremely intelligent, extremely bright, but may not have the background in STEM, you know, science, technology, education, that may not have the higher, may not have had calculus classes, may not have had the opportunity to study American history at a more, you know, intense level, that it's really, really important. And he's pushing this, and I want your reaction to this more than anything else, that when they come to the school, the school's obligation to these students remains, you know, at a higher level than to students who come from privileged backgrounds and attended top flight prep schools or, you know, highly rated public schools and affluent school districts. So I like your response to that.
Well, I mean, I think that's noble, and that's a noble effort to, you know, pluck out, you know, I guess, where the best and the brightest. But, you know, again, that still leaves the children in the middle, or maybe the children on the lower end of the spectrum, in bad situations. And so I guess the ultimate cure would be to try to solve the underlying systems of funding education that create failing schools that allow children to mire in failing schools based solely on where they were born. If you take, and I read this and it was an amazing analysis, but if you take you take credit scores and you overlay them, districts or areas where average credit score are between 500 and 550, if you overlay that map, you'll find crime, you'll find failing schools, and you'll find a level of poverty and unwillingness to, I won't say unwillingness, but the inability to move forward in life. And so I don't care if it's in Appalachia, I don't care if it's in Washington, D.C. When you find these poverty zones, you find systemically the same things. And so if we're going to cure this, it's not going to be by plucking the flowers that come out of those situations, but it'll be by fixing the situation itself. So I don't think it has to be an either or. I think you do and both. If there are children that show a proficiency in, you know, the STEM, if there's a particular student that has, you know, artistic talents or qualities, yeah, maybe we can find ways to get those kids in situations where they can better greater society by cultivating their gifts and their crafts.
You know,
at the same time, we have to fix and heal and help the children that aren't at the exceptional level by fixing the systems and that breed the ineffective schools.
Well, I think this is such I so agree with what you said, and I think it goes that hammer and nail issue. So the president of a university, he runs the university. As long as we have kids who succeed at my school and they come from a variety of backgrounds, the problem is solved. I've hit the nail into the board without recognizing all the other, you know, the people who don't get into this, who aren't, you know, the university isn't willing to you know, can't, obviously. It's limited. Its resources are very limited. But exactly what you just said. And I remember years ago reading, many years ago, 25 years ago, reading this Thomas Sowell article about the talented 10th and how important it is in the African-American community to cultivate the talented 10th and make sure that they have all the opportunities. And I didn't disagree with what Sowell was writing, but I made the point, I was taking a course in civil rights at law school at that point with mostly African-American students. I made the point, Danny, but what about the 90% you know? That's great for the talented 10th, but it seems what Sowell was basically saying, and he was saying it, is we don't need to worry about them. And that's exactly backwards. Yes, we should worry about the talented 10th, you know, regardless, again, of background or ethnicity. Who are disadvantaged, but they're the ones who are most likely to be able to succeed, you know, even under very tough circumstances.
Well, we have a educational system that is, you know, been commodified to the point where you can buy good education for your children. If you take two 5-year-olds and you send one to a private room, private school setting where there might be two teachers, classes of 13 or 14, and you're getting hands-on education. You're developing the ability to critically analyze information and to make decisions based on, you know, the information at hand. If you're learning how to think, how to problem solve. And then you put a kid at 5 years old in a school system where they're going to be taught reflexively on what is the teacher showing you. We're going to drill, 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 test, 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 you know, ABC, ABCD, you know, multiple choice questions and test, where it's just checking if you've been able to memorize what someone's taught you. I mean, that's a different level of education. And so, you know, we have a tiered education system, and we always have. I don't know what fixes that, but you can't spend $25,000 on a elementary school education and think that, you know, someone miring in a public school that maybe has funding for $7,000 per student is going to get, you can't reasonably expect those two kids to have the same level of education.
All right, let me get Douglas on, because we're almost at the end of the hour. I do want to get Douglas on. Always very provocative and thoughtful. Douglas, you're on with Danny and Hal. Go ahead, Douglas.
Yeah, one of the things that, and I'll tell you, I'm always forthright. I've never completed my master's in economics. But FDR did the homework. We have the homework in our hands of how you move society and get jobs and create wealth and just self-respect and dignity for your citizenry. So it's not secretive that, you know, how do we get the masses working? How do we get poor people from behaving poorly? No, don't let them be poor anymore. Give them a job. Give them resources. Give them an avenue. We did it with the GIs coming out of the military. Everybody got an education and training for free. That was the reality. We've done the homework. We've been in this situation before, and we won't follow the homework. We created Social Security and unemployment insurance and all these things to support a nation, and we just won't do it. We've made a conscious decision on the left and the right that those aren't issues for us anymore, that somehow we can elect a Hillary Clinton to be our representative and cheer her on.
You know what, Douglas, you and Danny have different views, and let's try to parse them out just a little bit. So Danny was saying, the Thought Wrestler said, thoughtwrestler.blogspot.com, but I haven't promoted him nearly enough in this show, and I'm sorry about that. But our guests are regular every 2 weeks, Danny Cardwell, the Thought Wrestler, thoughtwrestler.blogspot.com. Also, he posts regularly, and is one of the moderators at dagblog.com. So, you are not obviously, Douglas, you don't like Hillary Clinton. But Danny says, hey, she voted 93% of the time the same as Bernie. And she does care about income inequality, and she does care about health care and environment. So maybe she's not perfect. Go ahead.
There's nothing to do with it. Her sincerity is not there for what she stands for. You can't tell me what you stand for. I mean, she didn't go speak to Occupy Wall Street. She went and spoke directly to Wall Street. She has not been there. She has no successes as a senator or as Secretary of State. And so, she came to this election without a platform. Bernie Sanders gave her the platform, and all of a sudden she had to pivot and go, wait a second, we better have more than five debates. I mean, that's a reality. I mean, look, everyone's going to vote for Hillary Clinton. I have the luxury of being in California, so I don't have to vote for her because she's going to carry this state anyway. So my conscience will be clear. But the reality is that, you know, hey, family home leave, child care. I mean, those things are talking to the populace of Kansas who just lost their, you know, their health insurance because of their governor. And so I just want to say that FDR, which I did, you know, part of my work on, we have the homework for the infrastructure of our nation. Donald Trump's going to win the South because he's talking about, you know, jobs. Not that they, you know, relate to a wealthy billionaire. It's that he's talking about, look, I'll stop these trade deals. You know, they're unfair to us as a populace, as a nation.
So is there anything you think Hillary Clinton can do to change that at this point in the campaign? If you were consulted,
of course, but she won't do it. She won't come across the sincerity. So she's going to win not only the votes, the Democratic nomination, but she's going to win the vote as a nation. The numbers, if the numbers weren't there for Romney to win, you actually believe from the bottom of your heart, I mean, with that fear tactic of Trump, that he can win?
You know what? I'm just going to say this honestly. I look at the numbers now. I think right now Trump is in a better spot, as the polls show, than Romney was.
Quit reading the numbers. Don't be lazy. Quit reading the numbers. You know that you're trying to. That's
what else can I use? What else am I supposed to rely on?
I mean, the electoral votes aren't there. If Romney didn't win, and he's not carrying near the baggage of the divisiveness of a Donald Trump, how the hell can a Donald Trump win? The numbers aren't
because
there.
Here's
why.
Here's how I'll answer that, and then I'll let you go, okay. Douglas. You can call back.
I'll make one more comment.
All right. Here's how I can say that. Because I look at Pennsylvania, which is a lot closer than it was in 2012, and I look at Ohio, which is a lot closer than it was in 2012, and while it's true that the unfavorability for Trump is much higher, it's also true that Clinton's unfavorability ratings are much higher than President Obama's were.
And so Romney could go in and he can have a percentage of Asian votes, a percentage of Hispanic votes, and certainly the regular or normal percentage of women votes. But Donald Trump can go in there with all these issues and concerns, and he can win.
All right, let me ask Danny respond. Danny.
And then I want to make one more comment. It's just the numbers aren't there.
All right.
We don't have enough white folks to vote for
Trump. All right, well, just hold on. Hold on. Hold your fire, because I got to let Danny go. It's been. He's well past his sell-by date. But real quick, Danny, you heard Douglas. He doesn't like Clinton nearly as much as you. He's the kind of person you have to defend Clinton from. But he also says there's no way Trump can win. So I want you to just leave us on that point. Is he right?
Well,
is there no way? Go ahead.
Well, first off, Douglas, I admire his passion. I've heard him on the show several times, and he's very knowledgeable. And the attacks he's leveled against are based on facts or voting record. They're not ad hominems. They're not personal. He has deep concerns, and those concerns need to be addressed. And, it doesn't sound like she'll ever be able to address those. But, it's fair. His critique of her has been fair. I want to push back only because it's a narrative that's gone around that, Donald Trump will win the South because he's talking about trade deals. Donald Trump has offered no substantive proof that anything he said on trade is able to be based in reality, that he has any ability to alter trade deals in a way that will be beneficial to the American worker. He has held multiple positions on trade in the same debates. And so it's just we use it as prima facie evidence that Donald Trump is going to be better on trade deals. And I just don't know how that started. Like, I don't know how. And again, if Douglas is saying that people believe this and hence they'll support him, that's one thing. But as the media goes, we've accepted, the media has almost accepted this as just a fact that Donald Trump is going to be better on trade. And I just refute that. But Douglas makes good points. As far as the electoral map and the deficiencies that Donald Trump has with the electorate, I just don't see those getting any better. I wouldn't tell anyone to be overly confident because folks need to get out and vote. There will be efforts to disenfranchise voters. I hate to say that, but I've worked closely in elections. My wife's the election chief in the area we live. I've read too much of this and I've seen too much of this over the course of the last decade and a half to pretend like it won't be an issue in 2016. So folks need to get out and vote. I don't know if she can garner the sort of Obama-level support amongst people of color, but Donald Trump might do that for her, So I don't know. I think Douglas is closer to right when it comes to the general election than some of the skeptics who are following some of these polls too closely.
All right, Danny, thank you so much. I kept you for over an hour. I greatly, greatly appreciate your time. Remember, you want more, read more of his work, go to dagblog.com, go to thoughtwrestler.blogspot.com, and listen every other Monday on this show, and you'll hear him. Thank you, Danny.
Have yourself a great day.
Right.
Enjoy the show.
Always great to talk to you. What a great guy he is. And, Douglas, you are too. Yeah, I'm not as optimistic that Trump can't win. And I also think he missed a point a little bit there. you weren't necessarily saying Trump will be better on trade. You're saying people don't trust Clinton on trade, and he at least talks about it from a very strong pro-American worker perspective. And she knows.
That's all he's doing. He's just talking, and that's what people want to hear at this point. Whether he can execute or not, who knows? I mean, Obama talked a big game, too, and people voted for him. And it's not whether Trump can execute on it, and as far as the X's and O's, as Danny mentioned in the as far as the media goes, they don't care at this point. Donald Trump doesn't have to show his taxes. They don't care. They're going to vote for him because he sounds as if he's looking out for their best interest, and as far as Donald Trump goes, the nation's best interest. And so he may not be able to execute, but that's not going to stop him from voting at this stage. He can do anything he wants and say anything he wants at this point, and he has a certain level of popularity that's not going to shift one way or the other at this stage. But one of the things I also wanted to talk
about. Well, wait, let me ask you a question. Let me jump in, because I'm really curious about something else, because there's always this argument, is Sanders more electable than Hillary? In the Real Clear Politics average right now, Trump versus Clinton, I think Trump has a lead. Trump is ahead, according to RCP, by 0.2%. So it's basically a dead heat. But Sanders, on the same website, the same Trump versus Sanders metric, has a lead of over 10 points versus Trump. Does this, to you, is this powerful, convincing evidence that Sanders would win and Hillary might well lose the general election?
So Hillary won't lose the general election because it's not the fact that whether Donald, it's hers. It's almost like she can't lose. The numbers are just in her favor to that point. And when I start looking at these polls now, and I read a lot of alternative media, and I know one, there's a woman that calls your show that says you should, try to take a look at listen to the French News 44 or something like that. And you said, I can get enough of my news locally or nationally. I don't need to go to an international piece. But I believe that the consolidation of the media, they're going to extract as much advertising dollars from Trump and Hillary Clinton and the Republican Party and the Democratic National Committee and also all the private PACs as they can. So they cannot show that there is a favorable election towards one or the other at this stage. They want these guys to start spending those ad dollars and that money like you wouldn't believe. I mean, because we're talking about over $1 billion in advertising. I mean, that's going to go towards this presidential election. And they're tired of giving Donald Trump free money. So they've got to make it close. They've got to make it a fight. And that's my opinion. That's how I have.
Well, assuming that's true, or one other piece of evidence that actually kind of supports what you're saying is if the media is just simply in it to promote a very, very close, exciting race where no one can, it's unpredictable, because that means more dollars for them, more eyeballs watching their shows, and more advertising dollars, obviously. Well, I think the fact that in the polling, Sanders does much better than Clinton against Trump also supports that theory, because maybe the media wants Sanders to keep winning, so they keep getting to sell more ads in advance of the ultimate nomination.
Right. I mean, it's all going to four or five companies anyway. They're saying, hey, look, we can't have, we need a fight. It's almost like promoting a boxing match. I mean, we need to make this thing happen. And when you lay down the map of what the numbers that Romney won, and he still lost. I mean, then you're going to say, well, Donald Trump has none of these going for him, and he has excess baggage, and they're saying, like, this is going to be a close race. I mean, Donald Trump can't carry any of the states in the West. And when I mean, like, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, I mean, he'll carry Utah. I mean, California, Oregon, and Washington. So that's a wash right there. Montana's up in the air. But there's Wisconsin. The red states that he'll cover, he's not even guaranteed to cover New England. I mean, all six New England states. I think he can get one, maybe. Other than that, that's true. But one of the things I also wanted to bring up that you and Danny talked about, as far as and we're always giving excuses for Democrats to go to war and bomb another country or strategically make moves around the globe, is that they have to do it to prove themselves. The first black president has to prove that he could be tough and he can be tough against Muslims because they always accuse him of being a Muslim. And then the woman will have to be tough because she's a woman, and they want to make sure that, you know, she has the ability to, you know, what we call defend the country. These guys are, it's all a big, I mean, they're all in on it. I mean, we're strategically, you know, placing military bases in Poland, and, you know, and arming Poland and Lithuania and Latvia. And the TPP is about putting military bases, you know, in Asia, you know, surrounding China. I mean, they just announced, the president just announced this weekend that we are going to, you know, lift the arms embargo for communist Vietnam. You know, a country that we were at war with because they were communist.
I don't know why they're are we selling communist. Arms. We shouldn't even be selling arms. This is a sort of a shot across the bow at China. That's why we're going to sell the arms to Vietnam. But the real issue is, of course, the rise of China that we abetted, we created, and we're continuing to help because of the imbalanced trade we have with that country. That's what we should be focusing on, not arming Vietnam.
We are so wealthy as a nation that not only did we lifted China out of poverty. I mean, we allowed China to become, I mean, it's
not, well, we impoverished ourselves in the process, at least our working class, the middle class. Douglas, listen, I do have to let you go, buddy. Thanks for the call. Great call. Let you go at this point. Great to hear from Douglas. We've got to go to that break, and we'll come back. I got a clip here from Meet the Press, Hillary Clinton. She's not paying no attention to no stinking polls. We'll be back. Thanks for listening to my show.
It's Thursday, May 19, 2016.
All of this with the global warming and a lot of it's a hoax.
Donald Trump promises to toss historic UN climate agreement.
The voices of the people were heard.
Native American tribes halt massive coal export terminal in Washington State. Voters halt massive Nestle water bottling plant in Oregon. Duke Energy ordered to close all toxic coal ash pits in North Carolina. Plus, another big climate victory for kids in court, this time in Massachusetts.
All of those victories and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Climate scientists say that April was the hottest month on record. It was so hot, Donald Trump tried to make out with it.
Ew. This is your Green News Report.
It's a beautiful month. April to total 10.
Okay, Desi Doyen, you've got so much green news today. I know you can barely fit it into 6 minutes, so I will do my best to shut up. You're welcome.
Okay. In North Carolina, 2 years after a toxic coal ash waste spill into the Dan River shut down the drinking water supply for 300,000 people, the state's Environment Agency on Wednesday ordered the company responsible for that spill, Duke Energy, to close and clean up nearly all of its coal ash waste pits in the state within 10 years.
That's good news.
That's a big deal to stop widespread groundwater contamination. Millions of gallons of toxic coal ash waste from Duke Energy's coal plants sit in unregulated, unlined pits, but the company plans to seek a rate increase to pass along the cost of the coal ash cleanup to its customers.
Of course. And by the way, the governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory, what did he do before he became governor?
Oh, he was CEO of Duke Energy.
Oh, go figure.
Donald Trump says that if elected, he'll renegotiate the historic United Nations Paris Agreement. On Tuesday, in an interview with Reuters, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee panned the landmark global climate agreement, which was unanimously adopted after decades of negotiations by all of the world's governments to reduce emissions and confront climate change. Trump says he believes that China will renege on the agreement, but in reality, of course, China is well on its way to meeting its pledges and leads the world in renewable energy investment. It's worth noting that if Trump has his way, the only nation that would actually be reneging would be the United States.
And he needs to renegotiate with how many countries? About 200 countries signed on to that?
Yep.
Good luck.
In California, the pipeline company responsible for last year's Refugio Beach oil spill near Santa Barbara has been indicted for failing to maintain the decrepit onshore pipeline, which ruptured and spilled nearly 150,000 gallons of crude oil that killed wildlife and fouled miles of California beaches. Houston-based Plains All-American faces 46 criminal counts, including 4 felony charges, and potentially could see more than $2 billion in fines for the incident. but they made $43 billion in revenue last year, so they'll probably be okay.
Exactly, and it'll be a tax write-off if they get any fines.
Another victory for kids on climate in the courts. The Massachusetts State Supreme Court this week ruled in favor of four teenagers who sued the state of Massachusetts for failing to regulate greenhouse gas emissions as required by a 2008 state law. The justices agreed, ordering the State Department of Environmental Protection to write and implement carbon emissions regulations by the end of the year. It's the latest in a string of lawsuits brought by children around the country to force state governments to act on climate change.
They're making the argument that, hey, we're kids, and therefore you have a responsibility to take care of the environment that we are going to inherit.
That's right.
And the courts are agreeing.
So far, so good.
I like it.
Voters in Hood County, Oregon, on Tuesday voted overwhelmingly to kill a new water bottling plant proposed by food giant Nestle. They voted by nearly 70%. The voters passed the countywide ban on large bottled water operations, effectively blocking Nestle Water's plan to tap a spring that supplies their municipal water. Supporters said the plant would bring jobs. Critics said it amounted to privatizing their public water supply amid a drought. Finally, in Washington State, a massive proposed coal export terminal has been stopped. After a five-year effort by grassroots activists and Native American tribes, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has denied a crucial permit for the proposed facility at Cherry Point because it would have decimated the treaty-protected fishing grounds of the Lummi Nation tribe. The grassroots opposition campaign was the deciding factor, according to Marianne Hitt, director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, in a recent interview on the broadcast.
Demonstrating the power of advocacy, in addition to the Lummi Nation, we had hundreds of thousands of people across the Northwest speak out against these export terminals, and the voices of the people were heard. And so it's a victory for our climate, it's a victory for our treaty obligations, and it's a victory for democracy.
The coal industry proposed six massive coal export terminals for the Pacific Northwest. Five have been canceled so far.
Lots of victories today. Thank you, Desi, for much more on those stories and all the ones we couldn't fit in. Check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
All I do is win, 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 no matter what. Got money on my mind, I can never get enough. And every time I step up in the field, everybody hands go up.
Vengan a ver esta palomita que me encontré en su nido. Está echadita.
Oiga, señor, we are federales. You know, the mountain police.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
All right, well, that's, I guess, what Hillary Clinton thinks about those polls. She don't need no stinking polls, and she was on Chuck Todd, asked about that issue on Meet the Press. Well, look, how come Bernie's killing, by the way, sorry, Treasurer Sierra Madre, thought I had closed that clip, but didn't. Great clip, by the way. He doesn't say we don't need no stinking badges. I don't need to show you. I think he said, I don't need to show you no stinking badges. And then in Blazing Saddles, they stole from that scene. Great scene, by the way. So Clinton is with Chuck Todd on Meet the Press. And she is in a dead heat. This is yesterday. She's in a dead heat. And Bernie's beating Trump by up to 15 points. Let's talk about that. Chuck Todd, Hillary Clinton.
Our country.
You know, it's interesting, though. He is making a case, Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, to superdelegates. And there's a memo, another memo they put out this weekend, just showing how strong, much stronger he is against Donald Trump than you are. Our own poll, he's got a 15-point lead over Trump. You have a 3-point lead over Trump. You made an electability case 7 days before the final day of the primary season to superdelegates back in 2008. Why shouldn't superdelegates, you wanted them to listen to your argument 8 years ago, why shouldn't superdelegates listen to the Bernie Sanders argument and say, you know what? Maybe he is more likable.
Well, first of all, people have voted for me overwhelmingly in the Democratic primary process, and that is absolutely clear and very different from where we were in 2008. I could make the case, which I did, that I was actually slightly ahead in the popular vote when we ended that primary, but I was behind in the pledged delegates. It's also fair to say... I have been vetted and tested, and I think that that puts me in a very strong position.
You don't think Bernie Sanders has been vetted? You don't think this one long year of campaign, your campaign against him, has vetted him?
Let me say that I don't think he's had a single negative ad ever run against him. And that's fine. But we know what we're going into, and we understand what it's going to take to win in the fall. And finally, I would say that, you know, polls this far out mean nothing. They certainly mean nothing to me. And I think if people go back and look, they really mean nothing in terms of analyzing what's going to happen in the fall.
Do you think this lead for Sanders is an illusion a little bit?
I'll let others speak to that. I just think that I'm in a much stronger position, have been, and the voters who have turned out and given me 3 million more votes believe that as well.
Right. There's a lot in that 2 minutes. Very interesting conversation, and it is horse race analysis, which we always complain about. Let's talk about policy. But you know what? Who is more electable is really important. And I have been a Sanders supporter who's been one of the few who hasn't been prepared to simply say he is more electable. I've said it, but then I've kind of backtracked. And I mentioned today, I do think that if it was a general election, if it was simply a matter of who gets the most votes, Bernie Sanders would get more votes against Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton nationally. But we don't decide elections that way. We base them on the Electoral College, and I think Clinton has the advantage, at least in Florida, which is such an important state, or if she doesn't have an advantage over Sanders, she's not at a disadvantage either. So it's very difficult for me to just simply say, because the average polling right now shows Bernie 11 points over Clinton, and she's basically in a dead heat with 11 points over Trump, and she's basically, Clinton is in a dead heat over against Trump. Therefore, he's more electable. I think that's tough, even ignoring everything else, because we decide the race based on the Electoral College. But Clinton made another argument. I think it's a fair one. She said, hey, he hasn't had a negative poll, a negative ad run against him. I think that's pretty accurate. I was going back over this, and certainly the Clintons have lied about Bernie, said that he wants to repeal Obama, take away people's Obamacare. They have misrepresented the cost of his proposals, saying that we can't afford affordable Medicare for All, when in fact we would save money if we had it. But in terms of actual attacks on him, attack ads, we haven't had those. And for Clinton to say, you know, I've been, my unfavorability ratings reflect, at least in part, people's belief in the ads and the attacks over, you know, 20 plus years against me. And Bernie's never really faced it. I think that's fair. I do. I don't think she's misguided in bringing that up. I think she's wrong when she says polls mean nothing. They do mean something. At this point in the race, they mean something. Generally, these polls at this point, 6 months out, less than 6 months out, well under 6 months out, 5.5 months out, have had some real predictive power. So I don't think the polls mean nothing. I also think that her argument that she's been vetted, yes, it has validity when he hasn't. But who's to say that when the Republicans go after her in earnest, that won't cause her numbers to continue to drop? You know, part of the question of whether you're popular or unpopular is what's happened to you in the past. But the fact that she's faced an onslaught, often unfair, doesn't mean that more attacks won't continue to cause her favorability ratings, which are very low, to continue to erode. The polls aren't meaningless. They aren't dispositive. They're not, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, they're not determinative, but they're not meaningless either. So I think this is really an interesting conversation. Finally, Clinton makes a point at the end, which I totally agree with. This is how we choose a president. We have primaries. This is how we choose a Democratic nominee. We have primaries. I won the primaries. Many more people went into the primaries and voted for me than voted for Trump, for Sanders. And that's how we decide who's going to be the Democratic nominee. I wish, you know, that, you know, if you're Bernie, you say, well, that isn't how we decide. We decide with the superdelegates. But the problem there is he's been railing against the superdelegates. He's been saying the superdelegates don't count. So which is it? Do the superdelegates count and you want them to reverse the will of the voters in the Democratic primary, Bernie, or do you argue that the will of the people should stand? If that's your argument, you lose. It's tough for me. It's really tough because I'd much rather it be Bernie. But, you know, look, if the situation was reversed and Bernie had a big lead in the popular vote, how could we possibly argue that Clinton should be the nominee? I guess we would react with incredible anger, resentment, rancor at the argument that Clinton should be the nominee if Bernie had the most votes in the Democratic primary. And any arguments that she was more electable would fall on very deaf ears, just as they did when she claimed she was more electable. Now, there's a difference. In 2008, she said she was more electable, but the evidence didn't support that claim. Right now, the evidence does support the claim, I think, that Bernie, or at least there's strong evidence that he's more electable. All right, interesting. 844-4-HELL-G. I'll tell you the only way around this, folks, and it won't happen. Her lead is too great. But yeah, if you go out there and you give him a big, big win in California, which I think is unlikely, that is going to cause more consternation. Is that what we want? Here's what I want. I want Hillary Clinton to recognize, I want something to get to her where she starts to think, part of my problem with the electorate is because of me. Part of my problem is because of the way I come across. Part of my problem is the positions I've taken in the past. And I'm going to change. I'm going to change right now. I'm going to commit to more populism. I'm going to commit to championing the little guy and little gal, not the big banks. I'm going to commit to deals that create good jobs for Americans. And to talk about this openly, that's what I want to have happen. And that's how I think she can win. All right, I see you, Julius. I'll get you in a bit. It's going to be a few more minutes before I get you, though. 844-4-HELL-G. 844-367-4254. 844-4-HELL-G. All right, I'll tell you what. Let's go to Julius after all. Julius, good morning. Because I got another story, but I'll move to that after your call. How you doing, Julius?
Yeah, you say you don't like to keep your callers waiting unless it's me, right? You always have new rules, different rules just for me.
I don't like to keep my callers waiting, but on occasion I do. And in this case, I thought I would.
That occasion just always happens to be me. Why didn't you have the thought wrestler for an hour? He wasn't scheduled.
Yes, he was. He was scheduled.
I have to check your website again. I didn't see that.
Well,
I don't see that.
Then he was scheduled in my head if he wasn't on the website. I'm going to check right now, Julius, because I think he was in there. I'm saying he was in there. And I posted this yesterday. So let me look. Monday, Times Below Our Pacific, 7. Thought wrestler Danny Cardwell calls from Shenandoah.
Maybe I have a different Hal Ginsberg website. Let me look. Let me look.
I spelled Shenandoah wrong. It's
What is this? How come it says, let me go back here. Oh, this is from the previous week. Oh, that's where I got confused. My bad. I apologize.
All right, now
what
did
you think? What do you think about?
I got
a
question. I'll take yours. I got to ask you this question. I want to read you this email. This is from Terrace. Terrace writes that he keeps having problems with the tune in, that my show keeps repeating itself, like when you eat certain foods and then they repeat on you, they come back up. He's saying that's what's happening. He listens to the show on TuneIn. He said, I've been listening to you forever. And I listen, and then after a while, I hear you say the same thing you said 30 seconds ago. Have you noticed that problem?
No, I have not.
Yeah, I don't really notice that either when I listen. It may be that your internet's a little slow. That could be the problem. I'm sorry, Terrace. Okay, Julius, what do you want to talk about? I'm going to turn off my mic.
Very slow internet now. I used to have fast internet, but hard times, you know. So mine is real slow, and I don't have that problem. Now, you know, I would not do it. I thought, wrestler, I would appreciate if you would not speak for me. I would not do it. I would not sell out for any amount of money. I would not sell out the starving children for any amount of money. I would not, you know, go to Goldman Sachs and tell a bunch of lies. What do you think?
Well,
wait a sec.
So you're saying, let's parse this. You're saying when he said he would go to Goldman Sachs if they offered him the money, You're saying that's selling out. Is that selling out? Yeah. Is that selling out, though? Is that selling out?
Well, if you're going to go there and tell a bunch of lies, which he obviously, well, tell them what they want to hear, you know, tell a bunch of lies, well, say a bunch of evil things for money, yeah, that's selling out big time.
Okay. Okay.
And I would not do that. I would not sell out the starving. I'm desperate for money.
Can't she just make those speeches public? That's what pisses me off.
I was going to ask you, what did she say that is so horrible she's afraid to let people hear it? It must be something really horrible, right?
You do think that.
How can you not think that when she's afraid to release the transcripts? It must have been something so horrible, right?
I really wonder. Yeah, I think it may also be the principal, though. You know, she just wants to say.
Oh, geez, principal. Talk about an oxymoron. Hillary and principals? God, give me a break. Hillary has principals? Newsflash.
Well, I don't mean
to.
It's not a principal.
I would
stand on, Julius. Hold on a second, John. I got Julius in front of you right now. We're talking, but let me keep you on there, John. Just you can mute your phone if you possibly can. Julius, I'm not saying it's a principal like we have to.
You can
feed.
Put me on with John if you want.
He's on. It's not a principal like you have to feed starving children. That's a principal. It's a principal.
Is John
like,
there? Can John
he
hear
is.
Me?
Yeah. Yeah, you're here, John. You want to say hi to Julius?
What do you think, John?
Oh, I just joined in. I missed part of
the question is about was Hillary Clinton selling out when she went to speak to Goldman Sachs, or is the real
no,
problem?
No, what is she so afraid to release? It must be something so horrible, right, John? What is she so afraid of? She must have said something really horrible.
Wasn't there one of the guys that was there? I read some article that one of the guys who was in the room said that the way her language could be interpreted was that they were being demonized. That she was speaking in a way that the public was demonizing Goldman Sachs for what had happened, and you know. Go team, go.
Yeah, like demonizing Satan, right? God, people should stop demonizing Satan. It's so wrong.
Well, I just think whatever she said, she needs to stand by it. And she should have made it, by the way, would have been much better if she had made those speeches public against Bernie Sanders, because then the Democratic Party would get to decide if it really matters to them and it's important and whether it matters. But she wouldn't do that. I think that's outrageous. Real quick comment from a listener saying, when I say she won, she's ahead by 3 million votes, it's not fair. Because that doesn't include his advantage in many caucus states. All right, but the advantage in the caucus states it still pales by comparison to her enormous wins in many primary states, including really big states like New York and throughout the South, where she won by huge margins. Yes, he won some caucus states by big margins, but you don't know if there was a general election in those states, a primary.
Hey, let me ask John a question.
He would have won
anywhere
near as big. As,
let me
as,
ask John a question. John, when you talked about the bonds, right, you said that Trump said he's only not going to buy new bonds. You didn't say he's going to forfeit on the bonds that we owe money on, right?
Yeah, that's how I interpreted it. He didn't want to roll them over, you know, to keep public debt circulating. You know, he was under the impression that somehow paying off those bonds and negotiating a lower rate for them would be good for the economy, but it's the same sort of mentality that Herbert Hoover espoused that made the Depression much worse than it was, and which is why I think he got back, you know, into the public eye and in the spotlight and said, well, you know, we can pay these. It's okay to pay them off because at full value because we print the money. He still doesn't get it.
So you're saying, though, that Trump's sort of saying, I'm not saying we should default on our obligations. We just shouldn't issue, we shouldn't borrow more money is basically what he's saying. By the way, you said something, John, that I kind of disregarded or had trouble understanding. I really did some additional research. This was on how the Federal Reserve can put more money into the economy or take more money out. And I think you were spot on. When I did more research, I realized you were spot on. You said when the Fed issues bonds or sells bonds, it's taking money out of the economy. because the bond purchaser is paying money into the treasury. That takes the money out of the economy. That is correct. I did some additional research on that. You're absolutely correct. I was thinking, well, but when the interest is paid, then that's putting money in, but it pales in comparison with the amount that's taken out instantaneously. And of course, the Fed can continue to sell bonds and thereby take money out of the economy, as you suggested. When the Fed, instead of selling bonds, pays bonds off but refuses to issue more bonds, then it's putting the money back in. So you correctly.
No, you got that wrong, Hal.
I did? I did? How'd I get that wrong?
Isn't
that right, John? John, did I get that right? John, did I get that right?
Yeah, it's kind of difficult. Let me talk my way through this. When the Fed banks buy bonds, they're essentially buying them from the Treasury, and they're doing it because the government needs revenue, so that puts more money into the economy. When they're trading their bonds, it really doesn't have an overall effect on the money supply. But when they're cashing in on their bonds, when the Open Market Committee says it's time to reduce the number of bonds in circulation, which they're not going to do because they really only do that when there's a lot of tax revenue being generated and the economy is starting to experience inflation because the government is spending too much, right? So what the government would do, what the Treasury would do, would be to, on bonds that they are now paying off the principal, they would not reissue those bonds. And that would be the call that the Fed would make. The Fed would say, don't reissue some of these bonds. But I don't think I think it's been decades since we've done that, because inflation hasn't been a problem.
Yeah, if inflation is a problem, we issue more bonds. If inflation is a problem, we issue bonds, because when the purchaser buys the bond, they're taking money out of the economy and putting it in the treasury. And by doing that, that reduces the supply of money, which raises the value of the dollar, and that is the opposite of inflation. Inflation is when each dollar is worth less, as opposed to worth.
No, you got that wrong, Hal.
No, I don't.
You got that wrong.
I don't.
Okay, you don't know what you're talking about.
I don't. Inflation is when prices go up and the value of each dollar drops.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. When prices go up. That's what
because
it's about. Well,
yeah,
you know,
because there are too many. I'm sorry.
Too many dollars. No, because you're right, John. All right, final point from you, Julius, and I'm going to let you go. Final point. I want to get to John, and I got another story I want to tell people about. So go ahead, John.
Yeah. What do you think would happen? What do you think would happen if, you know, Russia went into Germany and they were getting close to getting our nukes? What do you think America would do?
I just don't think that's going to happen. But it is scary thought.
Say, theoretically. Theoretically, if Russia went into Germany, right?
Yeah, I that's too unlikely a scenario. I appreciate the call, Julius. You know, Russia has been aggressive. I mean, look at what happened with Ukraine. But on the other hand, many have argued we goaded, right, John? We goaded Russia into attacking Ukraine or supporting the Ukrainian separatists. All right, by the way, you're listening to the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show, broadcast on Radio Monterey. Radio Monterey broadcasts shows for the open mind. I do encourage you to check their schedule out at, of course, RadioMonterey.com, and listen to all the great shows from all the talented hosts at RadioMonterey.com. All right, John, what's on your mind, my friend?
Hey, so I was calling, I wanted to talk about the possibility that if Hillary's numbers keep sliding against Trump, will it make more and more people realize that they've kind of been sold out by the DNC, you know, that the DNC was willing to gamble with their future on their pro-corporate candidate? When Sanders clearly has a strong advantage, will they look at this and say, God, we could have had this other guy. Why did they push her on us, you know? So
well,
hard
but John, and, but John, 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 though, look, mm-hmm. she won the primaries. She did. I mean, how is the DNC? I agree the DNC has done what it can to help her. There's no question. But the voters voted for her. They didn't vote for Bernie. He won some states. Sure, he did much better than one thought. But she still got more votes. More people who went to vote in primaries voted for her than for him. And she has many more pledged delegates than he does. So how is this ultimately an injustice to Bernie Sanders? Aren't you asking for the superdelegates to reverse? I mean, and I'm serious about this question. Are you not calling on the superdelegates now to reverse the will of the people?
Is that not their stated purpose?
Well, that may be. I'm not disagreeing. It is designed to prevent some unelectable candidate to become the nominee. And so that's an argument. But Bernie's been arguing that there shouldn't be superdelegates at all. I mean, now he's arguing just the opposite. He hasn't been saying all along, well, you know, I hope we win the popular vote. But in the end, it's up to the superdelegates to decide whether they think I or Senator Clinton is more electable. Or Secretary Clinton is more likable. That hasn't been his argument at all. His argument has been the superdelegates are unfair. There is a big thumb on the scale in favor of Hillary Clinton. And I would say if you remove that thumb, Clinton still wins.
You know, you could be right. I think you could be right. And just what I'm wondering is, I kind of leveled that complaint in the wrong way. You know, who will the people, when people realize, when more and more people realize that Sanders was indeed the stronger candidate, who will they resent for it? And what sort of impact will that have on the election or even post-election if Trump wins?
Well, I think they should resent the voters in the Democratic primary who voted for Hillary Clinton. And I think they should resent the DNC mucky mucks, nabobs, who pressure, you know, gave her advantages wherever they could, such as in the primary and the debate schedule. But, you know, look, if you want to blame someone, you got to blame, I think, the voters who vote for her. If she doesn't win, and it seems clear that he would have, I would blame the voters who voted for her just in the primary, just as I blame the Nader voters for giving the election to Bush in 2000.
Well, I was one of those. I was guilty, but
it was in
the
state. It was a state where she was going to win.
Yeah.
Where he was going to win, and he did win anyway, right?
You know, and a lot of those Nader supporters were trying to do that responsibly. They were trading votes online, saying, you know, I'll vote for Nader. You would have a Gore supporter in California saying, I'll vote for Nader if a Florida Nader supporter will vote for Gore. And they were doing that, and the Republican Party slipped their lid over that.
It isn't even just Florida, because the analyses seem to suggest that also in New Hampshire, the Nader voters were sufficient to give that state to Bush. So either one of those two. And I know Nader will always say, well, if only he had won Tennessee. Okay. It's not only on Nader, but Gore was trying to win. He may have made mistakes, but he was trying to win. But you, Nader voters, were actively acting in a way that you knew or should have known was going to make it harder for Gore to win the election. So you bear more.
I don't know how they could have foreseen exactly how terrible of a president George Bush could be. I do know that, their purpose was to get more voices into the national discussion. They knew Nader wasn't going to win, but they did know that, there were incremental steps that needed to be taken to build a third party system, and that's what they were trying to do. That was the impetus behind the Nader movement. And the Republican Party at the time was extreme, but not nearly as extreme as they are now, and not the perceived threat that they are now. And so now there's a better argument to be made.
Yeah, I was pretty scared, I'll be honest with you, I was pretty scared of W. I really was. I mean, he was a political newcomer. He had a history of dirty politics with that Karl Rove character. He had as his running mate somebody who was very, very scary, Dick Cheney. He had been calling for big tax cuts for the wealthy. I think it was clear at the time. He was a scary choice. Hey, John, let me switch gears for a moment, and then I'm going to let you go also. But I'm asked this question of Julius. I'll ask you the same. Because Terrace in Santa Cruz is complaining that he can't, that there's problems on TuneIn, and that he listens, and then it stops and replays, and it's very irritating. Here's what Terrace writes. Thanks for the free content. Your show is great, but I feel like unless I complain about this problem, it will keep costing you listeners. So are you noticing that as well, a stammering feed?
Yes, I am. What it is it's a loop. It's right now we're talking. All of a sudden, it could go back 30 seconds in the conversation and start over. And essentially what happens is the little bar that you can push back and forth, like tune in, you know, you're streaming, so you can go backward in the conversation voluntarily if you like, if you missed something, but it kind of moves that bar back. So the conversation continues, but it increases the amount of time that you got to spend to listen to the show.
I see.
What I was going to suggest is a simple Hal Ginsberg app that really, really has no bells or whistles, but just streams straight from your website, unfortunately, and not through TuneIn, because it does not happen with Tom Hartman or, you know.
I've noticed that with Tom Hartman. You know what I have noticed with Hartman? I will be walking around listening to Hartman, and suddenly it goes back.
Okay. In the past, it has for me. I don't know. I honestly don't know what causes that, but I know that it happens more with your show. Maybe I just don't. I actually listened to all of your show. I only listened to parts of Hartman's show.
I mean, I've definitely heard it with Hartman a lot. I got to tell you what, it is not surprising to it happens with Hartman. There's no question. Let me let you go, John. I appreciate that.
Okay, hey, you know what you got to do? You got to just get your own app. I don't think it's that difficult. I think you know, the more complex you make your app, of course, the more it's going to cost.
I don't even think that solves the problem. Because, John, thanks for the call. It may just be an internet issue, although I'm sure Terrace will say he has fewer problems with other shows. But I have noticed this with just about everything I listen to on the internet at some point or another. But if it's happening frequently, that's a big, big problem. All right, phone number 844-4HELG. 844-367-4254 if you want to join me. And we're almost at the end of the show, only 10 more minutes left. Let me get to this story. It's totally not about politics. This upset me, and I really want your take, so please call in because I don't know what to think about it. So the two lions, are you familiar with this story in the San Diego. They do have a good zoo in San Diego, but I'm not talking about San Diego. I'm talking about Santiago. Santiago, Chile is, you know, the capital of that country. And they have a zoo, as most state national capitals do. And in that zoo were two lions, a male and a female. I don't know if they were mates. I don't know if they were just friends. But they had been there for some time. Apparently, they're described, according to Huffington Post, as beloved residents of the Chile Santiago Zoo, the Chile National Zoo, for over 20 years. So these were two lions who had been there for a long, long time, and people who went to the zoo would always like to see these two lions. Well, I was going to call him a jackass, but that's not really fair. Some very seriously mentally ill man decided to commit suicide by a lion. And that meant he was going to go into the enclosure and taunt them into attacking him. And this is exactly what he did. He actually stripped naked and began taunting them. Okay, now, I mean, I can make fun. What a dummy. How stupid could you possibly be? What a complete jackass. But for some reason, this clown, maybe I should make fun of him. This guy decides to jump into the enclosure and he strips naked. And again, he's taunting these big cats. It's not just about, being in the, it's not like, I want to pet the nice kitty, right? As I understand it at first, and this is not exactly what it says, but there were other stories, reports from Chile, from Santiago. As I understand it, the lions at first, these lions have been at the zoo for 20 years. These are not lions that are out in the Serengeti having to hunt down wildebeests and compete with hyenas for dead meat. These are lions that are fed every day. They're very familiar. People go and stare at them from behind the fence. So these aren't wild lions in the sense of a lion that, you know, has to kill what it's going to eat. So they tend not to be as aggressive. It's not always the case. Some could go crazy because they're in a pen and it's not natural for a lion. But generally, these two, anyway, apparently were not the most aggressive of animals. And they were older, too, right? Young animals tend to be more aggressive. Teenagers are more aggressive than 55-year-olds in general. Well, if some man strips naked and jumps into a pen with two lions, even if they're relatively domesticated and don't rely on killing other animals for food, if they're being taunted, they're going to respond. That's what lions do. And the two lions did go after this man and mauled him. Zookeepers arrived on the scene. This was all in front of lots of zoo-goers, horrified zoo-goers. Zookeepers came and tried to tranquilize with a dart at least one of the lions, if not both. But the tranquilizer dart hit the man, not the lion. So then the staff finally took out firearms and killed the lions. The man is in critical, not serious condition, but not critical. Looks like he's going to live. Do you kill the lions? Is that right? Is that okay? A lot of people are really mad. A lot of people say, why would you kill the lions? It's not their fault. They didn't do anything wrong. Does anyone think those lions did anything wrong? I don't. So why would you kill them? Here's what Alejandra Montalva says. She's the zoo director. The alarm sounded and chemical control arrived with tranquilizer darts and an independent shooter. The shooter decided to save the life of the person. Unfortunately, had to sacrifice two members of our family. The zoo has an established protocol because people's lives are very important to us, said Montalva. But she added she was deeply affected by the deaths of the two lions. Well, as you can imagine, the Chilean people were not happy. Chilean social media exploded with a firestorm of criticism against zoo authorities. Reactions range from calls to boycott all zoos to question about, well, maybe we should. Zoos, you know, if you're a lion, that's not your life. Your life shouldn't be behind bars. Even if I know they make them look nicer and there's grass and they can roam a little bit, but it's not like you go out and you run around on some plane and you hunt down giraffes and things. I mean, that's what a zebra, that's what being a lion is all about, I would assume. Maybe they like it. They just get fed steaks. The zookeepers go in, throw them a few, slices of meat, and they're happy. I don't know. But whatever, I'm sure those lions didn't want to get shot. So there were questions about the use of deadly force. Others commented on the treatment of people with mental health problems, like the young man involved. I don't know what they were saying. There have been vigil. There was a vigil at the zoo for the dead lions. Apparently, I said the guy shot was going to survive. I'm not sure if that's absolutely definite at this point, although I thought I had read that in another story. All right, I see Julia's trying to get another bite of the apple juice. You know what? I'm not going to give it to you. I'm sorry. You know, I like your calls. Just call back tomorrow. Just one call per show. There's no reason for him to get a second bite at the apple. But if you want to comment and you haven't called yet, I will talk to you about this. And I wanted to, what do you think? Were the authorities correct in shooting the lions to death, killing those two lions? These are lions that we, and you'll hear my bias. I'm not sure, maybe they were born in captivity. But either they were born in captivity, we kept them in captivity, people, we humans, kept them in captivity, or we actually hunted them down in Africa, because that's the only place we have lions. There's a few Asian lions, but I think these are from Africa. We went over to Africa, trapped them, shot them with tranquilizer darts, and then brought them to the zoo. Sold them to the zoo. And then some sick individual, developmental, disturbed individual, climbs into the lion pen and forces his way into the cage. Yeah, this is, remember I said that, according to witnesses, the lions initially ignored the intrusion. They were like, whatever. Well, you know, we're fine. Nice to see you. Good day, citizen. That was the original reaction from the two big cats. But then, Ferrada, that was his name, Franco Ferrada, taunted them. You know, he's like dancing, you can't hurt me. How do you blame the lion? How do you kill the lions? I can't believe, I can't do that. I can't say that's okay. Now, he apparently left a suicide notice. Well, now, I'm not saying, look, I mean, we should try to prevent people from killing themselves. Somebody jumps off a bridge and they're still alive. Let's try to save their lives, you know, by all means. Let's try to save their lives. But you killed the lion? The lion did nothing. The two lions. And I don't know if they were mates, a male and a female. I don't know. Isn't that awful? What do you think? 8-4? Oh, come on, I only got a minute left, so if you don't call now, it won't. It's too late. But maybe tomorrow, if you have a thought, I'd love to hear from you on this. 844-367-4254. 844-4-HELG. What's your take on this? Should the authorities have shot these two lions to death, or should they have let the lions maul the man to death? I mean, it is awful, right? I mean, he was being, you know, probably they were biting him and swatting at him with their claws. It is kind of gruesome and horrible. But then you think you're going to blow these lions away? I don't know. I mean, it's a tough one, right? In the end, I'm going to err on the side of the lions. What if it was a rhinoceros, right? It was a big old rhinoceros who was, you know, goring the man with his horn. Remember, rhinos are very, very, very endangered. Does it matter if the animal is endangered? Should that be a determining factor whether we kill it? What if it was a reptile? Do we say, well, a croc isn't as serious? You know, we don't care as much about a croc as we do about a mammal. I'm just, you know, just things to think about. All right, that's going to do it for me. Thank you for listening to the show. Greatly appreciate it. I'll be back tomorrow morning. If you want to talk about the zoo killing, we can do that. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. We got Tim calling in after the show. A little bonus if you listen to the past the credits. What do you think? Should the zoo authorities have shot those two lions to death?
No, I don't think they should have shot them. But, I mean, I think that's a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking, too. I mean, it's really hard to make a decision in a situation like that. You know, you don't necessarily think rationally when you see something like that going down. You just do what you do instinctually.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you see a naked man in this cage. He apparently had to force his way in, and you've got all these people who can ask him what happened because apparently.
But you don't know why he's in there. What if he's mentally ill?
That's true.
You know.
Yeah, and he was mentally ill. He is mentally ill. There's no question about it. So I hear you.
I mean, I think it's unfortunate. I think if they had a drink. Gun in the first place, why couldn't they keep using it? I mean, did they only have one dart?
I think they had more than one.
Yeah,
I think
it's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
It's very unfortunate they killed the lions. I think that's wrong. And if it turns out this guy was just trying to commit suicide and did not, I mean, if his mental illness was not so extensive that he could have made the decision not to do that, then I think he needs to be in a lot of trouble for what he did.
Yeah, he should go to jail. I think he will. I think they'll lock him up for that. Yeah. All right, Tim, I'll let you go, buddy. Take care. Okay. Great win by Bumgarner last night. Was that awesome? That was beautiful pitching last night. That was great. All right, take care.
All right.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye, Al.
All right, that's going to do it for today's show. Thank you very much. And again, this is the bonus edition of the morning show. Just finishing up the topic of the two lions shot in Santiago to death.